Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this best of edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. That's right, a best of edition. It is Thursday, October 12th, 2017. I'm Doug Hagman. I want you to sit back and enjoy not quite a blast from the past, but some relevant information, some really the best of the Hagman Report in terms of information, analysis. The reason, of course, for this is the entire Hagman staff. We are attending the wedding of my daughter, youngest daughter, Jackie, to Eric the Tech. And that's taking place this weekend. And, of course, we have to allow for a day of travel and some preparatory events, but it's really a day of celebration. And I want to invite all of you to join me in my celebration of this blessed event. And thank you so much for your well wishes and all of the notes that you have sent, emails that you've sent. But enjoy this broadcast, brought to you, of course, by Ready Made Resources. Bob Griswold there. Go to Ready Made Resources and shop. Let me tell you something. Prepare. Because what's coming, of course, is, well, you can see, can't you? I'm sure you can. All right. First up, Dinesh D'Souza. Take a listen to this most important message. Dinesh, of course, author of The Big Lie. Well, take a listen. This was not from that long ago. The Big Lie, one of the most comprehensive, one of the best books I've read about how the left, how the progressives, the communists, the fascists are lying about history. Here it is, Dinesh D'Souza. You know, one of my favorite authors is, well, more than an author, one of my favorite political commentators, a great mind, certainly a brilliant mind, and a man who has seen so much through, has experienced so much in the political arena, in the swamp, so to speak, or perhaps because of it, is Dinesh D'Souza. He's got a new book out called The Big Lie. It's right here, as a matter of fact, and I've read his book, and it's a fantastic book. And in fact, The Big Lie is an explosive new book that he's written. He's the author of the number one Times bestsellers, Hillary's America, America, and Obama's America. So what is the big lie of the Democratic Party, you might ask? That conservatives, and President Donald Trump in particular, are fascists. They're Nazis, even. In a typical comment, and I mentioned this earlier in the first segment, MSNBC host Rachel Maddow says that the Trump era is reminiscent of what it was like when Hitler first became chancellor. Talk about having being historic or being bankrupt in terms of knowledge of history. But in fact, this is an audacious lie. It's a complete inversion of the truth. Yes, there is a fascist threat in America, but that threat is from the left and from the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party itself, the Democratic left, has an ideology virtually identical with fascism and routinely borrows tactics of intimidation and political terror from the Nazi brown shirts. So true. And to cover up the insidious fascist agenda, Democrats loudly accuse President Trump and his supporters, other Republicans, of being Nazis. You see it in the video clips of people in the street, which is an obvious lie, considering that the GOP has been fighting the Democrats over slavery, genocide, racism, and fascism from the beginning. So pleased right now to have with us author, political commentator, and just a heck of a great guy, Dinesh D'Souza. Mr. D'Souza, thanks for joining us, sir.
Hey, it's great to be on the show.
Oh man, it's great to have you. So this new book really, I think, is your to me anyway, is the magnum opus, and it's so relevant, your magnum opus, and so relevant to today's events. I introduced the big lie, what it is, and I saw on your Twitter feed somebody said, "Well, what is it?" And you spell it out for him. We're seeing this play out. We're seeing this big lie being perpetrated by the corporate mass media, by the mainstream media, at least majority of it. And is that what propelled you to write this book? I mean, your observations combined with the media's proclamations?
Well, I try to write books that are both contemporary in their thrust, but that are anchored in some kind of a deeper historical or philosophical argument. And although the charge that Trump is a fascist and the GOP is the neo-Nazi party, all of that has obviously been at fever pitch since the election, the notion that fascism and Nazism are on the right, that they are somehow right-wing phenomena, that predates Trump. That actually goes back to World War II and the aftermath of the war, in which the progressives who were coming to power in the academy and the media, they knew that fascism was on the left. They knew that Nazism was on the left. But they also knew that fascism and Nazism had been completely discredited. And so they said, hey, let's cover all this up. Let's try to move these ideologies from the left-wing column into the right-wing column so that from now on, we can accuse Republicans, Christians, patriots, conservatives. We can stick the fascist tail, if you will, on the Republican elephant.
Very interesting. And I learned, by the way, I learned a lot from reading your book from history. I mean, I learned a lot of history or relative to history, especially on your chapter of Mussolini and the Democrats under FDR, for example. Now, you wrote here, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, that socialism, fascism, and progressivism are three similar, not identical, forms of leftism. Fascism lives on through American progressivism. And I thought that was fascinating. So, in that context, what we're seeing today really,
Yeah, part of what I was getting at was that if you draw a kind of a left-right spectrum, then on the left side of the spectrum, you have the people who want the centralized state. And that would include socialists, communists, progressives, and fascists. And on the right end of the spectrum, you have people who want individual rights and limited government. The other day, I heard that Bernie Sanders railing about right-wing extremists. And I thought to myself, well, who's a right-wing extremist? Well, a right-wing extremist is somebody who wants the government to be so small, so infinitesimal, that it would virtually not exist at all. So a right-wing extremist would be an anarchist.
Okay, which okay, and we don't. I mean, the anarchists—they're non-existent, as far as I've been able to tell. On the right, obviously, the now would the does that fit the left or the definition for the left? An anarchist would help me out with this, because now when you say anarchist, that applies to the left, though, the progressive.
Well, some of these Antifa guys, Antifa, of course, standing for anti-fascist, they call themselves anarchists. And it's true that they're willing to break laws and they're willing to ignore laws and they're willing to disrupt lawful events and they're willing to disrupt Trump's lawful election. But at the end of the day, they're not really anarchists. At the end of the day, they're collectivists. Because if you ask these anarchists, if you ask these Antifa guys, what at the end of the day do you want? Well, they want the powerful centralized state to use its power to intimidate and coerce citizens into line. They ultimately want what the Nazis wanted. The Nazis called it Gleichschaltung, which is bringing, it means coordination, bringing all sectors of society into line with the ideological priorities of Nazism. In America, we call it political correctness, but the left uses the same thing. They use the media, they use academia. The studio bosses in Hollywood trying to force people into ideological conformity.
Got it. And they're doing so, I think, very, very well. I think that the And I mentioned transference early. You talked about that in your book. You know, the Democratic Party certainly, or the progressives at this point, using transference. You make a great case there as well. You also write that fascism at its core is the construction of the all-powerful Leviathan state. And this is collectivism by definition, then, correct?
Well, Mussolini was the founder of fascism, not Hitler. In fact, Mussolini started the world's first fascist regime in 1922, and that was more than a decade before Hitler came to power. So Mussolini puts it very well. He basically says fascism means everything in the state and nothing outside the state. And for Mussolini, the state is kind of like a single living organism, and every individual is a cell within that organism. So the cell has no value unto itself. It has no rights. Its only value is what it contributes to the collective, to the state as a whole. Now, look, that obviously doesn't sound like the platform of the Republican Party. In fact, it closely mirrors the vision of the Democratic Party, and that's why fascism belongs squarely on the left.
Understood. Now, one question I had as I watched these thugs, these Antifa thugs, or those who identify with Antifa and their offshoots and their comrades, do you think, or do they believe, what do they believe? I mean, do they actually believe in what that they're fighting fascism? Have they been that far gone brainwashed that they believe and they've got no concept of history, or is this something different than what we're saying?
Well, a lot of these guys are, I think many of them are deluded. They're mindless. I know that at Berkeley, the conservative students tell me that one way that the Antifa movement is hounding speakers off campus is they just go down to Oakland and they get all these gangs to come onto campus. They give them these Antifa signs. These are just social misfits and people who want to cause trouble or get into a fight. So, you know, I think to me, that's the fascism on the street. Now, more dangerous is the fascism of the institution. So, for example, this guy, Jesse Aragon, who's the mayor of Berkeley, he's a member of one of the Antifa Facebook groups. He was apparently the guy who asked the cops to stand down to, quote, give Antifa room to maneuver, i.e. to beat people up. So I'm much more worried about the fascism of people who have badges, who have authority, who are in the university or in the media or in the police or in political positions of power. The fascism of the institutions is more dangerous than the fascism of the street.
And ultimately, yeah, I totally agree with you on that. And I see this academia, the infiltration of academia. And I look at this I think we talked about this last time. Is what we're seeing in terms of the academia, is that the fulfillment of years upon years of infiltration? Are we seeing the Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers of yesteryear marching on the streets, now filling the seats of our universities and pumping this out? Or is it even worse than that?
Well, part of it is the radical takeover of the universities, and conservatives have been very naive. I mean, focusing almost exclusively on political elections and not recognizing that while this is going on, the left has captured many of the big megaphones of our culture, not just academia, but also the public schools, the media, the whole field of entertainment, not just Hollywood, but Broadway, the music industry, the world of comedy, and so on. So, yes, I think that this has now become a very serious problem. And also the left has an ability to take its thugs and make them into martyrs. By the way, the Nazis did that too. There was a Nazi brown shirt named Horst Wessel, who was essentially known for beating up people and getting into bloody fights. But when he was killed by a communist, the Nazis wrote a song to him, the Horst Wessel song, which became kind of the Nazi party anthem. And similarly, I see in America and in the West, how thugs like Che Guevara or Bill Ayers, who's part of the Weather Underground, somehow these guys are transmuted from violent thugs into ideological martyrs and heroes.
Interesting. All right. One thing I do like about your book, and I don't want to jump ahead, but I know we're limited on time here, and you're so kind to give us your time this evening, because I do know that you're extremely busy. one of the things I really love about this is you actually show us how to deconstruct or denazify. You've got a chapter, denazification, for example, and you give examples on how we can fight back, getting rid of Obamacare, for example, repealing Obamacare and the Dodd-Frank Act and other things. Can we overcome? Oh, I suppose we can, but do you think, will we overcome the threat that we face, the peril to our republic that we face?
Well, certainly, I think we can, and I hope that we will. And I think that the more that we put ourselves to the wheel and use our influence, the better it's going to be. I've been a writer and speaker for most of my career, but I've pivoted now to also making movies. Why? Because a book can be read by 100, maybe 200,000 people, and that's a lot. But a movie is going to be seen by 3 to 5 to 10 million people. That's just a completely different level of influence. Similarly, for the ordinary guy in your, you know, sitting at home, you think, well, gee, what can I do? I only have 50 friends on Facebook. Well, yeah, but those guys have 50 friends on Facebook. So you have a kind of a an ability to multiply your influence if you actually exercise it. So I urge people to be informed. I think if they read my book, they'll become what I call a very dangerous American, because you'll be able to, in a sense, take away not only the race card, but the fascism card from the left.
And that's a very important thing, because many commentators will come on the air or go on programs and explain the problem, but not really provide solutions. Now, you provide solutions, but also the method of getting the solutions to the people, which I think is fabulous. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left, I think. What about the book are you most, I want to say, proud of? Because when I was reading this book, the amount of research I went into this, I think that you've done, and the amount of notes, my goodness. But is it the historical part? Is it the current part, the interfacing there? Or is it, if you were going to sell this book to the American public, and I know that sounds like a cheesy question, but what were you most fascinated or most proud of with respect to your book, this book?
Well, I think that my strength in both as a scholar and as a writer is to take ideas that are very somewhat complex, somewhat dense, but not only apply them to the world that we live in now, but explain them in a manner that anyone who, even if you know nothing about the subject, but you're moderately intelligent and you're willing to read carefully, you can learn a great deal. Now, when I began this book, I didn't know a lot of the stuff that's in the book. I began by tracing some parallels between things that were going on the left and in the Democratic Party here and over in Europe with the fascists and the Nazis. So, for example, I noticed the great similarity between, say, the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazi brown shirts. Notice that both are groups that love to wear, you know, elaborate costumes. Both of them practice terror and intimidation. Both of them pick on racial minorities. In the case of the Klan, of course, blacks. In the case of the brown shirts, it was Jews. And both are paramilitary organizations that are part of an official political party. The Klan was essentially an arm of the Democratic Party, and the brown shirts were an arm of the Nazi Party. So I knew about those parallels, but what I didn't know is the degree to which there was a sort of almost intimate in-bed connection between American progressives and Democrats on the one side and the Italian fascists and the German National Socialists on the other. These people were communicating, they were praising each other, they were reviewing each other's books. FDR was a huge fan of Mussolini. Mussolini revered FDR. All kinds of American progressives praised Hitler. So that's the mind-blowing part of this book, is that for most people, even educated people, you'd never know any of this. You'll never find it in a textbook. And yet nothing that I'm saying is even controversial in the sense that this is my opinion versus somebody else's opinion. I'm relying on irrefutable facts of history, mainstream scholarship, and so far no one has questioned, let alone refuted, a single fact in this book.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I just have to take a minute and tell you this is funny, because when you made the connection between, or you referenced in the chapter, I believe it was Mussolini's journey, or it was either chapter 3 or 4. I actually went, and I've got an old set of encyclopedias. So instead of going to your notes, which I ultimately did, I went to the encyclopedias, read about Mussolini, read about FDR, and there was virtually nothing there with respect to that relationship, that admiration, and how you found that, and of course substantiating through your footnotes and your endnotes. It was just amazing. So yeah, I got to tell you, man, I was blown away by that. And I don't think most people really have a clue about any of this or half of this that's in the book.
I mean, think about it. Here you've got the Nazis in 1935. They're drafting the Nuremberg Laws, which turn, you know, Jews into second-class citizens. They segregate Jews into ghettos. They prohibit intermarriage between Jews and other Germans. Later, they involve the confiscation of Jewish property. So the Nazis who are drafting these notorious laws, what do they have in their hands? They have the blueprints of democratic laws of segregation in the American South. And they realize that the Democrats are doing the same thing. They're segregating blacks. They're prohibiting intermarriage. They have state-sponsored discrimination. They have racial terrorism. And so the Nazis go, great, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just take these democratic laws. We'll cross out the word black. We'll write in the word Jew. And we're off to the races. So I show in the book that there aren't just similarities. The Nazis are actually drawing on Democratic Party laws in the American South to draft up their own nefarious schemes.
And that is such a mind-blowing concept, really. And I'm just wondering how many liberal, progressive anchors, commentators, heads are going to explode over.
I got to tell you, this is why, I mean, since the election, all these people from Van Jones to Rachel Maddow, Chris Matthews, Bill Maher, they've all been bloviating about fascism. Trump's a fascist. These people don't know what they're talking about. Now that I've written a book and they can see chillingly that I've got the goods on them, they won't have me on their shows because in 10 seconds I would make them out to be complete fools. And they know that. And so they've all gone running into their rabbit holes and they've all gone dead silent on me. And this is really, you could call it the intellectual abdication of the American left. At one time, this was a smart group of people, but it's very difficult to say that today.
You know, you make an important point there, because what we're seeing in terms of the Rachel Maddows, as an example, and at that level of political commentator, they are like an inch deep and a mile wide when it comes to the intellectual discussions. So indeed, you would just bury him with the facts that they couldn't handle. So I it's no surprise to me why they wouldn't take you on head to head. I'm sure you could bury him. Now you've got one thing I want to do before time runs out. Your website, The Big Lie, the book. I'm just not sure where I have it here. The website for the book, where you can get a signed copy.
BigLieBook.com, or my website, which is just DineshDeSouza.com, or just Google the book. It's available everywhere, not just in Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but also like in Walmart and Costco, and you can also get it as an audio book.
Okay.
It's available everywhere.
Yeah, and DineshDeSouza.com, right on the top menu where it says Home Bio News, book is right there.
Yeah, but I want to get a signed copy. I think you had them. I think the signed copies were on that one. The book, Big Lie, the book.com. Anyway, you can get a signed copy there, correct? I think.
Yes.
All right. That's what I want. All right. Perfect. And I would urge everyone to do that. Signed copies are great. And of course, all formats of the book as well. One last question here before we cut you loose. Your other books still relevant today. Hillary's America, anything new? I mean, how are they going, and anything new in those arenas?
You know, it's funny because we're obviously not living in Hillary's America, and yet Hillary's America, both the book and the movie, remain very relevant because they're also the secret history of the Democratic Party. The Hillary movie, for example, is 70% not about Hillary. It's about the Democratic Party, and it excavates a whole history. So I would say that just as this new book, The Big Lie, blows up the fascism card that the left has been trying to play on Trump and on the right, the Hillary book blows up the racism card. And really, those are the two most powerful cards that the left has. I'm pretty convinced that if we take away those two cards, these people will be reduced to kind of a writhing, blubbering mess. They don't have a whole lot else left.
And you've done a great job, certainly, of exposing the big plural, lies in that regard. But your new book, The Big Lie, Exposing the Nazi Roots of the American Left, number one. I mean, this is a fantastic book. And, of course, from number one New York Times bestselling author Dinesh D'Souza. We're up against here shortly the network break. I just want to say thank you so much for your gracious gift of time for coming on tonight. And please keep us posted as you progress with other works, and let us know how the book is going. Appreciate it.
I will do so. And thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
God bless you, sir. Thank you so much for your patriotism and for your truth-telling. Wow. Okay, we're up against the network break here very shortly. That was Dinesh D'Souza, the author of The Big Lie, Exposing the Nazi Roots of the American Left. Now, I've got to tell you, folks, I learned some things in that. As Dinesh D'Souza said, there are some things that he had to look up. But when I think the biggest thing for me, I feel like Columbo now, you know, remember Columbo? But one more thing. Seriously, I feel like the biggest thing for me was what he was explaining about FDR, about how history has been revised and falsified. Not that the fact it was. Not even to the degree that it was, but the way it was with FDR, Mussolini, Hitler, and flipping the entire narrative against the conservatives. Now, not the European conservatives, but the conservatives here in this country. Oh, man, he makes a great case. His book is and as far as I'm concerned, is highly regarded. It's one enlightened. And thank you for tuning in to this best of the Hagmann Report. What you just heard was our interview with Dinesh D'Souza, a patriot by any definition, a true American patriot, the author of The Big Lie, a book I just love that book. The information in that book is phenomenal. Next up, we've got a very special interview with Charles Sasser. Charles Sasser is the author of Crushing the Collective and numerous other books, but my favorite by far, Crushing the Collective, The Last Chance to Keep America Free and Self-Governing. Charles Sasser spent a couple of actually, he was on, I think, three different times over the last couple of months. His book is available at the WND Superstore. Please visit the WND Superstore and use promo code Hagmann for any of your purchases there. But in particular, Charles Sasser has written by far one of the finest books about what's really taking place in this country. And I would urge everyone to really listen closely what he's got to say in this. I believe this was his debut appearance. Yeah, Crushing the Collective, called by David Kapelian, who himself is a best-selling author of The Marketing of Evil. Now, David Kapelian says Crushing the Collective is a must-read for anyone wishing to understand and counteract the destructive thinking that threatens to destroy the unique freedom that has made America the greatest nation on earth. And that is so true, isn't it? American exceptionalism, isn't it amazing that Americans find themselves apologizing for being the great country we are? We had 8 years of apologies under Obama. But Charles Sasser, a very special man, I truly believe he's written one of the greatest books that will survive in history as the magnum opus of books about liberty, which is the American way. And Crushing the Collective is an accessible and authoritative analysis of the history of collectivism's rise in the modern world. And by collectivism, I mean communism and its infection on America's ethos. Gone are the days of a strong work ethic and common sense. In its place is a self-absorbed entitlement mentality that thinks the government should control everything, including what we think. Well, crushing the collective illuminates the very real dangers of this socialistic mindset that is currently threatening the Americans' freedoms and the very existence of our great nation. As Benjamin Franklin said, when the people find that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the Republic. I apologize for my lack of appropriate emphasis there. Therefore, we must know the destructive history of nations drawn into the collectivist deceit, or we will be doomed to follow their same path. How true is that? Here is Charles Sasser on the Hagman Report, by far one of the best, I believe, authors, and truly one of the best interviews. Have a listen. Again, you're listening to the best of the Hagman Report as we celebrate Jackie's nuptials to Eric the Tech. That's right, getting married to Eric the Tech, keeping it in the family, actually holding him hostage, perhaps. Well, take a listen to Charles Sasser. And don't forget, visit the WND Superstore using promo code Hagman. That'll get you a nice percentage off of all of your purchases. That's WND Superstore, promo code Hagman. And here is the Charles Sasser interview. Charles Sasser is an author. He grew up on a farm where poverty was a step up for him. And he served in the U.S. military for 29 years, active and reserve. He was a Green Beret, by the way. He served as a police officer for 14 years in two major cities, Miami, Florida, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. Actually, Tulsa, Oklahoma is where my friend Pat Campbell is. KFAQ. He's a talk show host in the morning, KFAQ, Pat Campbell. If you happen to know him, say hello to him from me. Good guy. He's got like, you know, a dozen kids. I mean, he's just a great guy. He's a great father, a great husband. He's just a great guy, great talk show host. But anyway, Charles Sasser was also a detective in Tulsa, Oklahoma as well. Then Governor David Boren referred to him as perhaps the best homicide detective in the nation. And knowing what I know of our guest, I certainly agree. He also attended school. He's got degrees in history and anthropology. And he's a director of criminal justice at American Christian College. Now, I went through his book, Crushing the Collective. And it was a fantastic book. One of the things, I marked something down here. I wanted to make sure, you know, you've all heard us talk about, make sure I got this right here. The cycle that liberty is the bondage to liberty cycle. It's called the tyranny to liberty cycle by Alexander Tytler. Now, when you look at that, according to it, humankind historically and endlessly goes around and around through the same cycle, from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from great courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependence, and thereon from dependence back to bondage.
Oh, that's where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're just waiting to be, waiting. Now, Charles Sasser has written a book, and it's available at the WND Superstore. Go to WND Superstore and get a hold of this book, Crushing the Collective. I've got to say, I enjoy reading it. I was informed by it. The Last Chance to Keep America Free and Self-Governing. Now, this book, to me, represents everything that we talk about. Includes everything we talk about, addresses everything that we discuss, but it also offers the solutions that we can employ to keep America free. And I thank him immensely, not only for his service to his country, not only for his service to our nation as a police officer, And perhaps, you know, as the Oklahoma governor said, perhaps one of the best homicide detectives in the nation. But I thank him for also writing this book. I think it's fantastic. Well, Mr. Sasser, thank you so much for your time, for your gift of time joining us here tonight on the Hagmann Report. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you for having me here. I'm privileged.
Well, I'll tell you something. The book that you wrote and provided us a copy with, thank you so very much, was an incredible read. And I read your bio, by the way, or I offered your bio right before you came on. I don't know if you caught any of that.
And I like from the Superstore page on WND, Crushing the Collective illuminates the very real dangers of the socialistic mindset that is currently threatening Americans' freedoms and the very existence of our great nation. And it goes on to explain a lot more at the WND Superstore. But a fascinating book. Charles, what led you to write this book?
What caused me to write it?
Yeah, what led you?
What was your motivation?
Well, I think it's probably because of current events. If we look at current events now, I'm a historian. If we look at current events now, this is not the first time that this has occurred. Matter of fact, this same cycle has occurred throughout history from the very beginning. And it occurs almost the same way, as you just pointed out to Alexander Tytler or Tyler, which it's referenced both ways, that we go through this cycle. Every society goes through the cycle. And if we look around right now, if we look at our society, we're back on the dependency stage. The next step is back to bondage. And you can see with the chaos that's occurring right now in our society that we're only one step away from tyranny. And I absolutely predict that if Donald Trump is elected again, he will be impeached. These people will impeach him. This is a silent coup that's occurring. It's the first time in our history that we've had a coup, but it's occurring right now, and we're witnessing it.
Let's talk about that, if you don't mind. And by the way, this is your hour. We just want to make sure you know that. So you can go anywhere that you want to go. But what we're seeing happen today, to me, this is the most perilous time in our nation's history in modern times. It dwarfs Watergate. It dwarfs the 68 riots. It dwarfs, I mean, I can't think of anything in modern times that compares to this. How do we get here today at this point, in your view? Because you go through a lot in your book, the historical parts of your book. I mean, it's just fantastic. It's a great resource, by the way. But how did we get here today with Donald Trump in the Oval Office, Hillary not, and all of the deep state operatives that are pushing against Donald Trump? How did we get here? I mean,
well, if you look at this, you know, it's an interesting point. Let's look at a little bit of history here. That the first settlements in the New World, first settlements, Jamestown and Plymouth Colony, were both communist. They were communist way before 1848 and Karl Marx ever showed up. The governor said, in both instances, the governor said that everything will be shared in common. We will do work in common. We will share the produce in common. And as a result, in the first 2 years, 80% of Jamestown perished. But once they began to give individual plots and let each person be responsible for his own care, what happened? Plymouth Colony did the same thing. They were almost all dead. But what happened? We had Thanksgiving. And as the governor said, never before did they suffer from want after that. But we didn't learn from that. We didn't learn from that. Mankind throughout history has always gone from the individual to the collective. The individual, the freest, most individual person ever in the world was the early pastoral people. If you didn't like the way things were going, you packed up your at level and you scooted out. You joined some other group or you had plenty of places to go. Well, we've lost that in recent history. And I think we can trace today's events back to 1945 anyhow. And probably 1920 and the 1920s. For example, you know that Hitler in Mein Kampf paid gratitude to the United States for many of the ideas of euthanasia from eugenics that was pretty much started in the United States, you know, trying to breed a perfect people. But in 1945, the Frankfurt School moved, well, you know, had internecine warfare between communists and fascism. Communism and fascism are the same. They're not one left and not one right. They're the same thing with very minor difference. Both of them are socialism. Both of them lead to the same conclusion. But at any rate, the Frankfurt School moved. They were communist. And because they were communist, Hitler kicked them out of Germany, out of Frankfurt. And they eventually end up in Columbia University in New York, where one of the Marquise and what was the other guy's name? Marquise and I've forgotten the other guy's name. But there were two of them there, the main points of the Frankfurt School. And they made the remark that communism, socialism, will never be brought to America by force as it was in the Soviet Union. That the only thing they could do was a long march to take over the institutions. And that's exactly what's been happening since then. All these years we've seen this, they take over the institutions of education, of media, of politics, of entertainment, and especially of education. You take over any institution and you corrupt it, essentially. And that allows you to take over the country. And that's what's been happening. And the thing is, what we don't seem to understand right now with all this cry, hue and cry about fascism, about Trump being a Hitler, about him being fascist. No, that's not what happens. You see, communism, pure communism, can only succeed in a nation, in a country that is pre-industrial, like the Soviet Union was. Pre-industrial was an agrarian society, so it took over. A society that is post-industrial, as the United States is, and a successful industrial society, the way it will be taken over is by fascism, the government insinuating itself into every area of our lives, which has been happening lately. There's an old saying that's something about burning books. People who will burn books will eventually burn people.
Yep.
Hey, look at what's happening now. Right now in this, our society, we're removing. Today, I read in the Tulsa World newspaper. I live near Tulsa. And what they're doing is renaming Robert E. Lee School. They're renaming streets. Same thing in Oklahoma City. And when it comes to an all red state, like the United States, the reddest state in the United States, you know that something big is happening. So we're moving all the statues that offend people. We're changing street names. We're going to bomb or blow up the faces on mountains. Just goes on.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But there's a purpose behind this. And the reason why it seems that we're living in insanity is because actually we are. I call it cultural insanity. And we keep doing the same things over and over again. And people say, let's be optimistic. Let's hope that we can revive, that we can remake, that we can bring back the United States of America. You know, I hate to be a pessimist, but I think it's too late. When we have 47% of our people dependent one form or another upon government largesse, then we have reached that dependency stage. You give people something, they don't want to take it away. And each individual thinks only of himself, not of the nation. What can I get for free?
Yep.
Give you an anecdote, if I may.
Sure.
I was, interrupt me anytime you want. Oh, I get started on things. I'm very passionate about it. I was an undercover journalist in Occupy Wall Street. Now, these petunias, most of them were college people. But these petunias, they had no idea of what they were asking. They were running around with signs that says, free education, free public transportation, free food, free everything. And I keep asking. Nobody knew who I was. I was as scraggy looking as the rest of them. Nobody knew who I was, and I keep asking questions. I would say, who pays for this? Why? The rich.
Of course.
Government will pay for it because it's not fair not to be it. But these are petunias. But here on this one table, they were rolling marijuana cigarettes and passing them out. It had the highest crime rate in that square block. Highest crime rate in the nation. The first night I'm there, there was a rape, an assault, some guy urinating on a police car. I mean, it went on and on and on.
All the stuff your mama would be proud of you doing, right? Rolling a fatty and peeing on a tire of a police car. what a great picture that is. Okay.
But who do we have? We have President Barack Obama, who comes out and commends these people as the future. Now, that's scary. Nancy Pelosi. I mean, it goes on. These are the future of the nation, they tell us. If they are the future, this is a scary future. And I believe it may be our future. Because look at the ignorance. I've taught at junior colleges part-time for about 40 years. And lately I begin to see these kids, you know, with their safe spaces. You know, they're being offended by everything. I begin to see these people. They're incapable of coping with reality. They're incapable of being independent. I'm firmly convinced of that now, that it's a mob mentality, a collective mentality. A collective mentality that this is crushed, it will crush the rest of the nation. And we're going to end up as Rome ended up. We're going the same way. If we look at Rome, we look at all the various nations, Greece, look at the Persians. We look at these societies, and they all went exactly the same way. You destroy the institutions. So you just go through them. You go through them. First of all, the perversion in Rome. You had all the perversion. We had 300,000 people, men, 300,000 of them in Rome who were on welfare, on the public dole. Able-bodied people were on the dole. We had barbarians at the gate. They begin to bring immigrants in to take care of the people themselves, because what happened? Our men became weak and effeminate and weren't able to take care of themselves. We see high taxation was going on. We can see all the things that we have seen in our society today that were occurring, and they were occurred in Rome, and here that cycle is again, and now they've been here. And, well, look at what we're doing to our men, for example. I mean, our men are shaving their chests and wearing earrings and ponytails, and in grade school, teachers are encouraging boys to be more effeminate, to be more sensitive. Hey, I don't want sensitive men. I want men.
Amen to that. And I just want to mention, thank you, Global Star Radio Network. We're going to skip the bottom of the hour break because we want to hear everything you've got to say. Mr. Charles Sasser, our guest is Charles Sasser. The book, Crushing the Collective, it's available at go to the Superstore, WND Superstore. Get this book. A couple of the chapters, and just had me rolling on the floor, a couple of chapters. How about this for a couple of chapter headings? Traumatized in Studentville. I don't need a dude. Wussification. I knew this book was for me when I saw that. Wussification. A gay world. Yeah. So, folks, this book. This guy, Green Beret, 29 years active in reserve military, homicide cop in two cities. He paid his dues. He knows what he's talking about. He's written like 60 books. I don't know, 10,000 magazine articles or art. This guy writes all the time. It must in his sleep. I don't know. But this book is great, Crushing the Collective. I just want to say one thing to what you were talking about now that I reintroduced you. I told my son, he came home with the day he comes home with an earring, he's going to have restorative surgery on his ear, because that thing's going to come out and I ain't going to, you know, I'm not going to, it's going to, didn't I tell you that? I was going to rip it out of your ear.
That and tattoos and everything else.
So anyway, all right, sir, go ahead.
But Charles, let's go back to Rome. We see that incrementally they've been able to push this for the the movement, the ignorance that we have now, people blindly going out in the streets to protest, not knowing what they're protesting, calling things fascist and racist without any basis in fact or truth. What's different? Is it the technology that's different about our society than any other society? Because I see, I mean, just if you look at what happened in Charlottesville, they've been pushing since the church shooting in the South, the Dylan Roof shooting, for the Confederate flags. And that was a little alarming. I guess I understood it to a degree. But then we see this event in Charleston, and then boom, all this change instantly. And it's not even in America. It's across the world. You see this, you know, all these people coming out to protest racism. All these people coming out to protest fascism. Half of them don't even know what it means. Is it the TV and the technology that's aiding in ignorance with these people?
Yeah, I think that the technology is a large part of it. You know, I recall from the Bible, it said in the end days, knowledge will intensify or something to the effect that wisdom will decline. And I think we're seeing that. If you look right now, nobody participates in anything anymore. They've even got virtual reality, those little goggles. So if you want to climb a mountain or you want to sail the sea, all you do is put on the goggles and you sit and get fat on the couch. And while you watch virtual reality. And technology, there's been all kinds of studies done on kids and technology, on their cell phones as early as 4 years old or 5 years old. They've got a cell phone and they play games and so forth on it. And so they sit and they play on these games. And this studies show that these kids are not maturing anymore, that they don't mature, that they don't essentially integrate within the community, that what we have is people isolated. And technology has isolated us one from each other. I can give you a couple of antidotes. For example, one of them, I was a performer for a dinner theater for many years. Well, we closed down recently. Why? Nobody participates. Nobody comes. Nobody participates. I was a cowboy. I was a roper, steel roper. I was a rodeo bronc rider in my early days and rodeo clown. But recently, I've been heading and healing. All the places that I was roping, all of them started closing down. Why? No young cowboys. They're all in the basement playing video games. And I firmly believe that go to any neighborhood anymore, and people are involved with machines rather than with each other. So I think machinery technology is a two-bladed sword. And I think that contributes to this sense of loss that so many kids seem to have had. So this sense that of hopelessness. I see it in hopelessness in students. I think this contributes to that whole enigma of that we're seeing that's occurring in this country. It almost compels people at times to join in these mobs. Because to find some kind of identity that they can no longer do individually. And I think individualism is out of style now. Collectivism is in style. The individual is no longer an individual. And he won't be as long as we continue to move toward a collective state in which we are told, you know, when we can eat, when we can sleep, where we can work. And it's reaching that point. I can see it happening. If we get, you know, 50,000 new regulations and new federal regulations in 3 or 4 years. We have 50,000 of them. And each one of these regulations takes a dozen regulations in order to enforce that one.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to appear hopeless. I don't want to appear hopeless. But if we don't crush this idea of the collective and go back to individualism, and we start by demanding that people are independent, we encourage people to be successful. We encourage people to be independent. And I think President Trump has been trying to do that. And but very few other people seem to realize what's happening. I think that's motivation for this book. I say, look, guys, look, this is what is occurring. If you don't wake up, this has happened throughout history again and again to every empire.
You're Crushing the Collective is our guest book. Go to WND Superstore, use promo code Hagman. You got to get this book, Wussification, that chapter alone is worth every penny of the book. But you know, to me, collectivism and control are symbiotic, and I mean, it's all about control, isn't it? Okay, that's what, you know, I figured that. Your introduction, by the way, of the book was just fantastic. How you explained about growing up in the best, really the best age, and yeah. You know, I just don't see us ever getting back to that point because of the collective that you talk about and the control that is being forced down our throats, and about your grandfather saying, I think it was your grandfather saying, you know, what can government do for me? Just stay the hell out of my, basically, stay out of my business. Yet everyone,
just leave me alone.
Leave me alone. That's right. And now it's kind of the opposite. So it's fantastic. We'll keep going, man. You're on a roll. I didn't mean to interrupt, but you're just, I love it.
Thank you. Well, you know, the best lesson I ever learned in life, best lesson, you know, like I think in my introduction, you said, you know, we were so poor that poverty was a step up. We lived at one time in a dirt floor chicken house. We lived in an old barn. My dad could neither read nor write. But we accepted nothing. We accepted no charity. You just didn't accept. That was humiliating to accept charity. So we made do, working in cotton fields and whatever. But one year when I was about 12 years old, I always like to tell this because this is the best lesson I learned in life. My dad, we must have been particularly hard up that year because my dad finally consented to taking what he called gimpy groceries, government surplus commodities. You go down to the county barn, sign your name, and the government fills your sack with beans and powdered milk and cheese and so forth, free. Well, it's my faithful, but it's free for you. But my dad was too proud to go himself, so he sent me, and I'm 12. Now, I've always been a scrapper. You know, I'm a fighter. Right now, I'm an ex-kickboxer, pro-kickboxer, an ex-boxer. And I was a scrapper growing up as a kid. So I'm 12 years old. I go down to the county barn, and I get in line to sign up to get the gimpy groceries. One of the workers there, one of the guys who worked there, government worker, I must have gotten out of line or something, but he pushed me. And here I am, I'm ready to fight this guy. And he says to me, boy, if the government feeds you, it'll do what it damn well pleases. Best lesson I've ever had in my entire life. I never accepted since then. I went home. And I told my mom what happened. She said, we will be beholden to no one. So we didn't take gimpy groceries. So, but the point, I think, more than anything else is once a person is dependent, once people are dependent. Okay, let's look at the black culture. Right now, everything's racism. I'll be considered racist. You can call me a racist, but I'm not. I mean, of course I'm not. But I will be. Why? Because what was this that 1984 George Orwell said? Those who speak truth will be demonized. Well, something, you know, I may paraphrase it. But at any rate, look at the black culture. You know, in the 1960s, and nobody wants to tell anybody about this, 1960s, statistically, there was almost no difference between the black culture and the white culture. The out-of-wedlock rate was almost the same. The fatherless rate was the same. The employment rate was the same. The crime rate was almost the same. What happened? 1964, the Civil Rights Act, we had the Great Society, fought all these things. Here, I always give anecdotes. What I do, I tell stories for fun and profit. I was traveling on a motorcycle for a year, living in a tent when I first got out of the service the first time. And I lived with a black family in Mississippi, and they were sharecroppers, and I lived with this family. And Papa George told me, he says, you know, things are changing. We're being told that Whitey is all to blame for for the black condition. Things are really going to change now, he said. And then I, in Miami, as a cop, I worked a salt and pepper team. Black cop, white cop, work in the ghettos. I was involved in the 1968 riots. And we haven't seen anything. They were bad. We had five people killed. I don't know, dozens wounded, injured. I ended up in the hospital myself. 13 bullet holes in my police car after 2 days.
Another Tuesday back then, right?
Sorry. Yeah.
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I just keep talking.
No, I don't mean to interrupt, but this is fascinating. And this, I promise, this will be the last time I'll interrupt. But this to me is fascinating because this is history that I can't use the P word, but the wussies need to hear. And thank you, Mr. Sasser, for writing this book and also for being on our program. This is what these people, this is what they need to hear. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, I would just say, but you know what happened to the black culture? Like Papa George said, they became dependent upon government. First of all, we said, well, you really don't need a father because you got welfare. We'll put welfare. So, you know, fathers are irrelevant anymore. And you can eat. You don't have to work because, you know, you're poor. And primarily a lot of it is because you don't work that you become poor. And tell me, don't call me racist. I grew up in poverty and I know how to work. So we had that. They became dependent. And next thing you know, we had the black population put back on the plantation in the ghettos. We put them back in, you know, because government promised to take care of them from cradle to grave. Remember during the Obama campaign when the girl named Julie on one of their ads, government will take care of you, essentially was what it was saying.
Yep. I'm not going to have to put gas in my car. I'm not going to have to pay, you know, my rent anymore.
Exactly. That woman who said that, remember. Very good. Yes, we don't have to do any of that thing. We don't have to be dependent upon ourselves anymore. Look what happened to the Indians. And I'm a quarter breed Creek Indian. My grandma's name was Rachel Sitting Down. But I lived on a reservation at Four Corners, and I have a whole reservation for a while one time. And alcoholism rates out of this world, suicide rates out of, you know, just soaring at the time. Of course, unemployment, they don't have to work anymore because... And we've destroyed those people. What people fail to understand, skin color has nothing to do with any of this. What it is the fact that we've taken groups and split them into groups and made some of them dependent on the government and turned them against everyone else. Oh, when I was on Occupy Wall Street, there was a little black guy. He and I, he's the only friend I really made there. And why have we became friends? Is that he was sending little buttons, selling little buttons for $5 a piece that said Occupy Wall Street on them. So he sell them to the tourists that walked by. And so had his little dreadlocks and the whole bit. And so I walked up one day and I said, "You're a dirty, rotten, lousy capitalist." And we both laughed about it and we became friends. Because here guy is that used a little invention, a little inventiveness, and was selling these pens and making some money. Well, all these other clowns are sitting there getting doped, you know, and protesting that they're not getting free stuff. While the politicians are saying, yes, these poor people, this is exactly what they need. We need more equality in this country. Let's make everybody equal in misery. And that's what we're doing. We're making everybody equal in misery. And and we think we've seen misery yet. We haven't seen misery. Because of what's happened, like you said, burn books. The next thing is you're going to burn people. We're already saying, you know, certain people, you cannot voice certain ideas. Do you realize we're now 46th in the world when it comes to freedom of press and freedom of speech? And primarily, Cheryl Atkinson wrote a great book on that, in which she stated that why we're so low in that is because of political correctness and self-censorship. Journalists like myself, I'm lecturing now at different places on freedom of speech and freedom of press. And people don't realize that we self-censor ourselves unless we speak in the approved manner about certain topics such as gay marriage, such as race, transgenderism. Unless we speak women in the military, unless we speak in the approved politically correct method, then we don't write about it anymore. We become cowards. So therefore, the media has become, the liberal media has become dominant in our nation, in our society. And it just, I don't know, it just, right now we're seeing, we talk about Rome and the other countries, they begin to import immigrants to do their work for us. Well, look what we've done. We want to open our borders to let anybody come, the poor, the downtrodden, et cetera, et cetera. And instead of asking for people who will contribute to society, these people come in and they're immediately put on welfare. And they're not even citizens yet. And non-citizens are protesting in the streets immigration policies. And they're here illegally and they're protesting that they're not left alone completely. So we see this cultural insanity infesting our nation. And unless we wake up, unless we become aware, which is what I've tried to do with the book, I'm saying, look, guys, this is what's happening. I end my book with the section on the decline, on what happens then. And I call it such things as epic misery. We'll all be equally miserable because there'll be nobody successful. Successful is punished. Success is punished now. That anybody's successful, well, they're not being equal. And then I say, hail the Messiah. Well, that was on Obama, and I have to. And the pod people. And that, again, goes back to the Frankfurt School when we had infiltrating all our societies in order to turn our country socialist. Look at the last election. Look at how many young people were drawn to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And
a lot.
Voted?
What the heck is up with that? Explain. Yeah. Explain.
And he
would have
won the primary if it wasn't really stolen away from him. And he had a really good chance of beating Trump if he did win that primary.
Yes, a socialist a Marxist, not a socialist, a Marxist. He went on his honeymoon to Moscow, for example. He campaigned against the Cold War in favor of Soviet Union. I mean, he had a Soviet flag flying when he was mayor there in that little town in Vermont. He had a Soviet flag flying in his office. And why do these people vote for him? He could almost became president of the United States, a Marxist, a confirmed. That's because people are not taught history anymore. The young people are not taught history. Have you seen some of these citizens on the street interviews?
Oh, yeah. Mark Dice is one of my favorite. It's amazing to see these.
Yeah, these people, I mean, you asked, well, one person said, well, asked, when was the Civil War? 1942? you get these kind of answers. Absolutely no knowledge of our history. And now we're destroying our history. We're destroying already stored crosses and religious symbols. You know, the next thing is we begin to destroy people. Look what you, if you try to speak on a college campus now and you're concerned. Me? I go to a college campus, guess what's happened? We have a riot. Because why? Because I speak something they don't want to hear that offends them, that is not equality, that is not part of the dialogue of socialism.
Charles, let me ask you this, and sorry for just jumping in here, but this is something that really gets me frustrated. So when was it okay for people to shut other people down, shut other people out, call them haters, racist, whatever the term is, because they what they say offended you or other people? What, because other people are offended in their emotional sensibilities, they think they can shut, they have the right now to shut another person out. When was the right to offend people implemented in this country to the point where that right was taken away, basically? It's been a right all throughout human history, but now, you know, how we better be careful. We don't want to offend anybody. When did that happen?
Oh, it like everything else. It was part of that march through the institutions, that long march through the institutions. It was a gradual thing. If you notice, first of all, you know, in high schools, we begin to have bullies. And you were taught that, no, you don't fight back against bullies. You give them your lunch money. Instead, you don't fight back. You don't fight back. It started with, you don't fight back. And then gradually it became, well, if you're a minority, and you speak, if you speak out against any minority, and it doesn't have to mean that you're speaking out against them as a race, but you're speaking out against certain conditions or something that's not, well, you can't do that. It was just a gradual, bit by bit by bit. And then pretty soon it just evolved. Most recently, under the Obama administration, actually, it really exacerbated under the Obama administration, primarily because, I mean, look, pardon me. He lit up the White House when gay marriage was legalized in rainbow colors. Now, what kind of insanity was that?
Yeah, that offended me, you know.
Yeah.
But you don't see them stopping because of the offense on other people.
Well, you can't be offended. You're conservative. Conservatives are not allowed to be offended by burning of statues or toppling of statues, or, you know, you're not allowed to be offended. But
Mr. Sasser, the one thing that I'm really concerned about is the speed in which we are seeing the events take place right now. This is breathtaking to me. As you mentioned, you know, you burn a book, you have to burn a body, basically. Paraphrasing now, but the statues, the shutting up of people. I mean, we're seeing this happen in rapid fashion, and few are standing up to counter this.
You remember, and when Barack Obama came campaigning for presidency, he made the remark there: "We're only 2 days away, 3 days away, or whatever it was, from the fundamental transformation of the United States of America." He was a man built for that time and period. He was men built for that time. He was, well, here, this sounds like conspiracy theory, but I can prove everything I put here. I document everything. George Soros funded the presidency, the campaign for Barack Obama. He funded the campaign for Hillary Clinton. There was a lot of money put into that. We keep saying that the left wants us to believe that the KKK and the white supremacists and so forth are a threat to our nation, or fascist threat. No, they're no threat. They have no power at all. They receive no funding. I mean, everybody knows that they're despicable people. So, I mean, even we all know they're despicable people. That whole idea is despicable. They're a small group. But what the group is that opposes them, they're large and they're well-funded and they're bussed in to oppose anything like that. And then we hear this narrative how fascism has taken over the country. Well, if fascism taking over the country, it's not going to come from people like the white supremacists. It's going to come from people like Antifa and all those people. That's where the fascism is coming from. Don't talk, don't write anything. Did you know that our books are now on the internet, are now being censored? That they're being
how so?
Okay, I'll give you an example, like Huckleberry Finn, a gem in there. You know, he was known as the N Gem. Well, N has been completely taken out, and a lot of the other books are being the same way. And Huckleberry Finn was actually banned on a lot of school campuses, along with several other books. But I fear. Do you remember there was a movie called Logan's Run, in which the people at 30 years old, they went on, I think they called it carousel, and essentially they were killed. And so there were no old people, but these man and woman escaped, young man and woman, they escaped when it's their turn to be killed. And they went out into the hinterlands, and they came across an old man, and they were amazed because they'd never seen an old person before. This old man had a library, and they'd never seen books before. And they were absolutely amazed. I'm telling you, I know what's going to happen. With the internet, do you realize how much power Google has when it comes to knowledge? Determine what knowledge is passed on to the people? And if the government takes over Google, regulates it as they intend to do, if they will do, then the government will control the knowledge, what kind of knowledge is transmitted. And who it's transmitted to, who can speak on it and who cannot speak on it. Talk about people who then talk about freedom of speech being curtailed. At that time, it will be. Well, and Charles, the books.
About Google, what's the difference if Google is tied up to this liberal agenda and believes in it to the point where they're already censoring? I mean, what difference would it be if they're already doing the work the government would do? Isn't that one and the same anyway?
Not yet. You know, that's one of the indicators of fascism, is big business and government working together.
Right.
That's one of the things. So what, you know, if the government regulates that company, theoretically it will still be a free, independent company, but it will not be. It will be regulated. It will be regulated by the government. Did you know that? For this is an interesting thing. Chuckie Schumer, our friend Chuckie Schumer, in Congress, Chuckie Schumer proposed a bill. It wasn't passed, but he proposed a bill that all journalists be licensed by the U.S. government, even down to bloggers. Now, we saw how well that worked out in Mao Zedong's China, which regulates not only the internet now, but it internates it. It essentially, you do what the government can tells you, and all their journalists are licensed, and so therefore they don't publish anything that the government doesn't approve first. Now we're seeing this begin to happen, and this ebook things will do it. There may be few books if this ebook craze continues. There may be few books that will survive into future generations. That much of our history will be destroyed down the memory hole, down George Orwell's memory hole. Much of what we of this society has preserved or thought valuable went to the internet, but then it will disappear down the memory hole in future generations. It'd be so easy because there may not be books in order to preserve this kind of thing. I mean, I can go on and on, which I guess I've done in my book. Which goes on in many different sections, government intervention, how government comes into the rescue. Government wants to protect you. I'm here to help you. You know, we can see, the regulatory, the public trough, like a bunch of pigs. We run for the public trough to get some free education. Bernie promised free education for everyone, that it was a right to have free education. When I went to college, I was 28 years old when I finally got there. Vietnam veteran, ex-cop, had two kids. So I get to college. And nobody wanted to hear it. Even then, it was coming to this political correctness stage. It was already starting there. I was never so disappointed in my whole life. I'd always wanted to go to the university. I was never so disappointed in my life. I was taught by a bunch of kids who had absolutely no knowledge of the real world. Some professors offered to let us vets, to give us vets of gentlemen C if we just not show up in class and pollute the class. These are the things that were happening then, and all the marching. You remember the marching, the anti-Vietnam marching?
Oh, yeah.
And you had this all the time, these petunias. Of course, I was very popular because I spoke out all the time. I still get, you can't believe the hate mail I get sometimes.
We can believe it. We get it here too. Oh yeah.
You get it.
Oh yeah. Speak out against a homosexual marriage. Get a used condom in the mail. It happens all the time. I mean, the most vile and some of the most crappy responses from this generation of putrid masses in some cases, and I'm sorry about that. We only have about two and a half minutes left of our time together. I can't believe it's gone so quickly. Charles Sasser is our guest. His book, Crushing the Collective, required reading, I believe, available at WND Superstore. It is, use promo code Hagman when you go there. Crushing the Collective, WND Superstore, author Charles Sasser. I want to thank Michael Thompson as well. Now, you've got the last word with a minute and a half, Mr. Sasser. Oh, by the way, let me ask you a real quick question. KFAQ, Pat Campbell, my good friend out there in Tulsa, you still live out there. I don't know if you know him or not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he does. Yeah, he still has a program there.
Man, I got to tell him about you. And I don't know if you know him or not, but you got to be on this program.
I think I've been on a program several years back.
Okay. All right. He's got to get you back on. This book is tremendous. Go ahead. You got the last word. You got about a minute.
Well, I think the only thing I can say is what we were living through. I always say that I had the privilege of living through some of the best days in America. And now I'm having being unfortunate enough to live through the final last days of America. And we will see the last days unless we can crush this whole idea of the collective. We are not collective. We are not collective. We are individuals. People can't seem to understand that anymore, that we are individuals, that we were the first nation in the world that declared that we were free and independent by virtue of God, and that built our entire nation on the idea of individual freedom. and now we're attempting to destroy the Constitution. Next thing to burn, we'll be burning the Declaration of Independence. We'll be burning the Constitution. We'll be burning people who disagree with it. And it's going to be some, as the Chinese philosopher once said, may we live in interesting days. We are living in interesting days.
Absolutely. Folks, our guest is Charles Sasser. His book, Crushing the Collective. Go to the WorldNet Daily Superstore, superstore.wnd.com. Use the promo code Hagman. But I urge everybody to get this book, Crushing the Collective, The Last Chance to Keep America Free and Self-Governing, by Charles Sasser. And
a guy that should be on every conservative radio and television show on the planet.
And I should say, pre-order the book, because it's not released until the 12th of September, 2017. That's the publication date.
We snuck one up.
Yeah, we're very fortunate. Mr. Sasser, thank you so much for joining us. We are at the end of our interview. We hope to have you back on here in the near future as we continue to watch what happens in the world and how the country changes, and it seems more and more like your book is right on the money for the times that we live in.
There's interesting times.
Indeed it is. God bless you and the missus. Have a great night. Thank you so very much for your gift of time, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Folks, we're going to be right back. Network break.
You're listening to the best of the Hagman Report. That was Charles Sasser. What a great author. Now, you from earlier this week, Jack Posobiec, an internet sensation, and of course an author, talking about, well, putting rhinos on notice. You know, we can crush the collective, but how? Well, Jack Posobiec is leading the charge, at least in one area, one venue, and that's by creating a super PAC. But what he's got to say, by putting the rhinos on notice, this is an incredible interview from earlier this week. Jack Posobiec, have a listen. And again, this is the best of the Hagman Report as we celebrate the nuptials of my daughter, my youngest daughter, to Eric the Tech. Celebrate with us by enjoying the past and not so distant past features of the Hagman Report. Here's Jack right now.
Welcome to this edition of the Hagman Report. Jack Posobiec, you know him. Everyone should know Jack Posobiec. He's a writer, filmmaker, recovering political operative, of course. In 2016, he was a special projects director for Citizens for Trump. Book by the same name, by the way. Fantastic book. It's like you were there. You got to get it. You just got to get it. It's on my Twitter feed. It's on Jack's Citizens for Trump. But that's the largest Trump grassroots organization in the United States. And originally from Philadelphia area, Jack has worked. And this is good because this is our home state. Jack's worked for presidential campaigns as well as numerous candidates for Senate, Congress, governor. He's got some really new initiatives coming up. He's also a veteran of the United States Navy. Multiple deployments overseas. I heard him filling in for or guest hosting in at InfoWars. When was it, yesterday or the day before? I don't know. The days all run together. You can follow Jack on Twitter for some of the most accurate, fast-breaking reporting in the business. That's at Jack Posobiec. And because of a video problem, he can't see us, but we can see him, and he looks great. So Twitter feed. Jack, welcome to the Hagman Report.
Hey, guys, thanks so much for having me on today. And actually, jumping ahead, since you mentioned it a little bit, talking about those initiatives that we're working on, I had to go. And so I've described myself for a while now as recovering political operative.
You fell off the wagon, didn't you?
I'm off the wagon, man.
Yep.
I've had a backslide. I've had a little bit of a backslide. I've got to come out of retirement. Because we're launching a new initiative. We're launching a super PAC. We did launch a super PAC. It's called Rev 18, Rev 18 PAC, Rev18PAC.com. And I've accepted a position as the political director of that PAC. So we are going to be looking to rain thunder and lightning down on Republican candidates in 2018 that do not have the president's agenda, the America First, Make America Great Again agenda at heart. We are going to be bringing their feet to the fire, and we're going to be supporting candidates like Josh Mandel in Ohio, who we just endorsed, candidates who do believe in America First. Josh Mandel, a guy who's a two-time Marine, two tours in Iraq, once at Haditha, a guy, amazing candidate for Senate, someone who absolutely needs to be in there. And I'm sorry, these guys like Sherrod Brown, these guys like Jeff Flake in Arizona, they are all going to be hearing from us very, very, very soon. Because we got Trump in there, right? We got Trump in there in 2016, and now he's the president, and now he needs backup. We've seen the logjam. We've seen the inability of the Senate and the House to pass his agenda. So the only thing we've got to do is replace the senators that are not playing ball. And we're going to do that through this super PAC. So I'm really excited about it. We announced it yesterday. So it is a joint project between myself, Jeff Giese, and Mike Cernovich. So the three of us worked together throughout the 2016 election with Citizens for Trump and the MAGA 3X project. It was a Get Out the Vote project that we launched with flash mobs, online social media, videos, so much stuff, combining that sort of grassroots activism with digital online activism. Now we're taking that up a notch. We're cranking it up to 18, quite literally, and figuring out ways that we can use our skill set and our ever-expanding audience for actual political results in 2018. It's very exciting. Just had a phone call with our lawyer this afternoon going over sort of all the do's and don'ts. And what's interesting is that while obviously we can't coordinate directly with campaigns as a super PAC, when it comes in terms of Twitter or social media, that's not considered necessarily paid messaging, right? Because I don't have to pay to put up a Twitter account.
Right.
So it's different from running a TV ad, running a radio ad, that sort of thing. So we're breaking down all these rules, but at the same time, we're actually kind of ahead of FEC guidelines because they haven't really released a lot of these rules for the internet yet and internet messaging. So we're going to err on the side of caution. And I got to say right up front that we're making sure that every penny that we spend, every penny that we receive is going to be annotated, that it's going to be outlined. Because, look, the establishment is going to be coming for us, right? We already know that. They're going to be gunning for us. They're already telling people, disavow. You need to disavow Posobiec and Cernovich. You need to disavow these guys. How dare you let them endorse you? And the guys are like, I don't know who they are. Well, actually, Josh Mandel does like us. He had said some kind words for us when the ADL was making false accusations about us. He actually stuck up for us, which was very nice of him. And we appreciate it greatly because that's the kind of leader that he is, where he'll stand up when someone's doing the wrong thing. He'll do the right thing. And they said, well, you need to disavow. And he said, why don't you disavow Barack Obama? Why don't you disavow Antifa? Why don't you disavow CNN? And so it's these games that they want to try to play because they're shaking in their boots. They saw what we did in 2016, and they know the power that we have to move the ball in 2018. And actually, it's already kind of gotten an early start because I was down in Alabama to endorse Roy Moore, to work with the Roy Moore people, basically on the grassroots front, to get him across and to basically expose Luther Strange for this establishment type that he was, who was masquerading, you know, as a Trump supporter. He put on the MAGA hat, and I actually broke the video because I was sitting kind of strategically. So Luther Strange walks off the stage with Trump. He's out there, puts on the hat, said rah-rah, slap each other on the back, walks off stage. First thing he does, he takes off the MAGA hat and walks away. And that it just goes to show you it's the perfect visual, right, for who that guy was. He was paying lip service to the agenda. He would not have been a vote for us. And now look where he is. Roy Moore won by almost 10 points. That's why Bob Corker just said that he's not going to run. That's why Never Trump congressmen like Charlie Dent have announced they're not going to run. And we hear actually more and more are potentially considering not running in the face of this. I just got a text message literally as I was signing on with you guys. So this may be breaking news. We'll see. But a certain senator from Kentucky might also be announcing his retirement very soon.
Huh.
So We'll see if my source is right on that. But a certain senator whose name we all know be announcing his retirement very soon in the face of this opposition and in the face of basically just getting schwacked and every one of his candidates getting schwacked in every single race that he endorses. So we're looking at, and it's, and you know, how great is it, right, that it's the southern heartland of America where this is starting to take place, right? Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, those areas that have been so overlooked by the bicoastal elites in the Democrat Party. Hillary Clinton wouldn't even consider campaigning in any of those places. How great is it that those are the places that are leading the charge to reform our own party, to reform the Republican Party by saying, you know what, this brand of Wall Street politicians, we're sick and tired of you. We're done with you. We want to bring the Main Street back. We want to steer it away from these like bailouts and outsourcing and turn it back towards what's best for the common American man and woman who have been forgotten for so long. And Trump ran on that. So that's in a nutshell, in a very long-winded nutshell, what we plan on doing moving forward. And I will say that one of the plans that we have is, so you know how most PACs or groups, they do endorsements, right? Right?
Yeah.
So we're actually planning on a new thing. Somebody said, well, whoa, what makes you guys different? What are you guys doing that's different? I said, well, and it's kind of set off the cuff. What we're going to do is we're going to disendorse people. We're actually going to find people like Jeff Flake, people that are out there like Mitch McConnell, and we're going to disendorse them, and that we're going to be running digital ads and digital videos against candidates. So we're going to disendorse as well as endorse candidates that we support. So you've never heard of that before. We're going to be the first ones. We're doing it right now. It's breaking in American history. We are disendorsing candidates, and we are moving forward smartly on that basis, because that's the type of thing. And when it comes down to it, really, right? In 2016, as much fun as everybody had supporting Trump, going after Hillary Clinton and exposing her lies and exposing her for who she was, I mean, that was such a big part of 2016, and it's going to be the same thing in 2018. We're taking the tools, the tactics, the techniques that we learned, and we're going to be turning them against these never Trump, neoconservative, Wall Street type Republicans, and we're going to bring the thunder. We are just going to bring the thunder. And as you can see, I'm very excited about it.
And as well, you should be. You know, you guys bring a lot of energy, and you get a huge response, both not only in the real world, but in the world of social media. And that's fantastic, especially when you're starting something like this. Jack, I want to ask you this, though. Where are you expecting to see some pushback from the establishment? I would guess that the Paul Ryan district of Wisconsin is one area. Where do you see some roadblocks that you're going to be facing in the 2018 elections?
So it's tough, right? We're going to be facing roadblocks from Karl Rove and his Crossroads GPS, their super PAC. We're going to be facing roadblocks from other people that are running around saying that, oh, we're the pro-Trump super PAC. But then you look at who they're working with, you look at who they're dealing with, and you find, no, you guys are just another group of people that's trying to waste people's money. We're actually trying to do this as little money as possible. We've only got $50,000 in the bank right now, and we're not taking on any large donors anytime soon. That may change, but we're going to be public about it. Our main goal in terms of pushback is going to be saying with these districts, right? So take Paul Ryan's district, for example. As you said, winning a congressional race is one of the hardest things to do in U.S. politics. Most people don't understand this. What do Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton all have in common? They all lost congressional races. None of them could be elected to Congress, but they did win the presidency. It's kind of one of those little ironies, because as Tip O'Neill used to say, all politics is local. And I'm telling you, man, local politics is a contact sport. So going into some of these districts, that is why it's crucial for us not only to have our ideas and our energy and our passion, but we have to work with local leaders to understand the facts of the ground in that specific race and what those voters actually care about. Now, I think there's some big ideals like border security and the wall, like immigration reform and like trade, that everyone is broadly, right, going to agree on in that sort of Trump coalition, as we're calling it. But we've also got to find what are those key local issues that are going to make people turn around and say, you know what, my congressman does deserve to be out of office. My congressman doesn't deserve to have his job anymore. And that's the issue, because Congress writ large has this tiny, 9% approval rating. But the issue is, is that everybody always kind of has this feeling like, well, Congress is bad, but my guy's really good or my gal's really good, right? So most congressmen have like a 92% retention rate when it comes because they just remember the name. There's so much oversaturation of, you know, people changing the name of the post office, getting using their franking privilege to send mail out to everybody. So we've got to go through district by district and find what specific issues we can focus on in that district and how do we target something from the national level and bring it down to a level that people are going to care about on the ground. And fortunately, that's my specialty.
Yeah, it is. You know, we had, I think it's Paul Nealon who's running against Paul Ryan in Wisconsin. Yeah. On the show, and I know we're going to have him on the show again. And then somebody who is a favorite of ours, Michael Snyder, he's going to be running for Congress in his district there in Idaho. And I think there's only three other people who are running against him, and the person who had the seat's going to retire or not is not running again. So there's going to be a new face there. But as far as the what kind of impact do you expect to see as far as the rate of change of some of these never Trumpers, you know, the establishment Republicans? How much effect do you think that you can generate by doing what you're doing?
We're going to have a huge effect. And we're seeing that in these early retirements that are being announced. I mean, people are falling like dominoes. I reported that that's what I was hearing. I reported that weeks ago. Everybody called me crazy. They said Posobiec is fake news. And now Corker has retired. Dent has retired. The senator from Kentucky, we'll see. This type of stuff that's going on is already having effect because they see the Trump voters that are motivated and want to come out. The issue, though, and I'll tell you what they're going to try to do, is the establishment is going to try to do the same thing they did to Trump in the primary. They're going to try to get multiple candidates to pack the primary and split the vote up among the Trump voters. This is what they do every time. I saw it with the Tea Party. I saw it so many times in the past, where they're going to try to get all these candidates to go against each other, divide the Trump vote, and then maybe like 30% of the vote will go to the top candidate. Maybe it's the incumbent. Maybe it's somebody else who's running that the establishment has endorsed. They're going to want that candidate to get to win. And even if he only has 30%, if it's a plurality, they'll still win. So where we come in is we'll be able to call that out when we see it, right? You saw it in 2016. It's what they tried to do with Jeb Bush, right? Jeb Bush, the plan was for Jeb Bush to win with about 30% of the electorate in the Republican primaries, and then everyone else would split it all up, Cruz and Rubio and all these the other people that were running, Kasich. So what we can do is by calling out, we say we disendorse this establishment candidate and that we endorse this one specific Republican because, and Steve Bannon actually said this best. He said, look, we're not going to support all the candidates we like. We're going to support the candidates we love. Because, look, when it comes down to it, you need a lot of things to be able to win a race. Name recognition, winnability, right? You've got to be able to raise money. We need people, and you have to have the right message. Trump, of course, had 100% name ID when he ran for president. So, and he obviously already had enough money to basically independently fund most of what he was doing. So not every candidate is going to have that built in. So unless they have enough of that sort of talent stack, as you call it, that's not going to be a candidate that even if they are 100% great on the issues, it might just be a race where we say, look, I don't think this one is winnable. We need to pick our battles. And that's going to be a key decision that we make internally. And we're also going to be crowdfunding a lot of this stuff, too. And crowdsourcing it. So we're talking, we're being so open that we're going out to the media like you guys, we're doing Periscopes, we're doing live streams. We are letting people see the inside of this. So if anyone does donate, if anyone goes to rev18pack.com and puts it in, we're going to show you what we're doing with all of it because we're going to be completely open and transparent. This isn't going to be like Karl Rove and he takes all of his money in from his billionaire friends and then just goes and spends it all behind the scenes. It's the entire opposite of that.
I love it. While we're taking calls, Mitch from Louisville, never mind. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I know what.
So let's see about that. Let's see about that.
Jack, we're gonna call you the most dangerous political operative in the country right now, and I'm gonna tell you, I really believe that. Seriously, knowing what I know about you, the most dangerous political operative, the most effective, formidable, in a very positive way.
Thank you very much.
Hey, we got to ask you something. And Joe and I were talking about this. What in the world? Can we switch topics just momentarily here? Vegas, Las Vegas, the slaughter on the Strip.
That's obviously the conversation right now. The new photos that have just come out in the last few hours confirmed, essentially backhandedly confirmed by the sheriff, who said, well, we can't confirm the photos, but we're going to investigate who leaked the photos. So, yeah, they're real, right? Looking at some of that stuff, trying to figure out, piece together what exactly happened. And I've been talking to a lot of my folks that from my former profession, working in the Navy, working with special forces, receiving some special forces training myself, to try to put together the tactical picture, at least, of what went down.
Well, you know, there are a lot of theories floating around, but there's new information that, you know, says the shooter had filmed himself during this attack. There are videos out there that are claiming to show, you know, a second shooter in the hotel room. And we always get reports like this in these shootings, and some of this is, you know, we just can't confirm right now. But one thing we do know is that, you know, the man up in the 32nd floor where the picture was of him dead, whether he shot himself or not, had a number of rifles up there. And you put a Twitter today. Every time the media uses the term assault rifle, they are spreading Nazi propaganda created by Adolf Hitler. Can you expand on this a little bit? Because we've seen the no motive being released as to why the shooter, did this tragedy. But we see this instant call for gun control. But let's talk about this term assault rifle.
Yeah, so that was a piece that I came up earlier with today. And so regardless of the shooter's motive, we obviously know what the left-wing media, mainstream media's motive is. And here is to institute gun control in the United States. They want to ban weapons like this. They don't want Americans to be able to defend themselves. And let's be clear, gun control means putting guns in the hands of political elitists, right? Because the police are going to still have guns. Private security in some cases is going to still have guns. Military still have guns. Who won't have guns are the men and women of the United States, who normally would have the right to bear arms. So that is what gun control does. The term assault rifle, okay, which you hear over and over and over in the media, it's not actually a technical term that's used anywhere in the military, anywhere in the shooting community, in the pro shooting community, because a gun is a gun, right? A gun is a rifle is designed to do a certain thing. So there's no difference between a hunting rifle or an M4 and other than specifically what sort of accessories it may have, what sort of cosmetic appearance it may have. But there's no actual functional difference. And you guys understand this. So the term assault rifle was actually created by Adolf Hitler in German because originally, when they designed the German submachine guns, he didn't like the name submachine gun because he said, that sounds kind of weak. That doesn't sound good. We want more we want something that has more of a propaganda punch, something that has more, emphasis of striking fear into the hearts of our enemies. Why don't we call these new rifles assault rifles? So it's used to assault. And that's the type of platform it is. And so it didn't actually mean anything, but that's what was used in Nazi propaganda. And that is where the actual term from German translated to English, assault rifle, comes from. And so every time the media uses that, they're actually falling into that trap of using and repeating Nazi war propaganda that was created by Adolf Hitler. Anyone can go and look this up, by the way. This is not like one of those Jack Posobiec just said it off the top of his head kind of things. This is The Atlantic reported this. You can go look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Most people credit Adolf Hitler with coining the phrase assault rifle because it was used as Nazi propaganda. And we see the media now using the same term, the same propaganda trick, as they push for more and more gun legislation. And we look at places like France or Chicago, right? Chicago, 4,300 shootings just last year, some of the most stringent and strictest gun laws in the United States. In France, weapons like this are completely illegal. And yet that did not stop the Charlie Hebdo shootings, and it did not stop the Bataclan massacre, 130 people killed. And that was done with AK-47s that were brought from out of the country, but over the country's porous borders through the Schengen zone. So we've seen again and again that these gun bans do not work. These gun laws do not prevent this sort of thing from happening. But what it does do is, unfortunately, take weapons that could be used for defense out of the hands of law-abiding Americans.
That's the big picture. That's the end game. That's the communist utopia they're going for, isn't it?
Well, that's what it is. I mean, we saw this with Hitler, right? We saw that before they called it the Night of the Long Knives, right? Before the communist, before the Nazi Party became militant, right? And people don't know the history because they haven't studied enough. They know enough to say Nazi, you know, evil, but they don't actually study how it happened. So the Nazis were a democratic party that participated in politics. Hitler was elected, right? 33% of the vote, became chancellor. But then once they solidified power, that's when they essentially instituted this Night of the Long Knives, Night of the Broken Glass in other cases, where they went after people in their own party. They went after the opposition. They killed everybody and basically turned it into the Republic, into a dictatorship. It was the Weimar Republic before, turned that into the dictatorship. So right before that all happened, not long before that all happened, they disarmed the country. They disarmed German citizens. They took weapons away from law-abiding citizens. They knew what they were doing, and it was part of a master plan. And we all know what that master plan turned out to be, the final solution turned out to be in that case. And I'm not accusing, obviously, the media of being complicit in something like this, but you really have to start asking the questions of what potential dangers, what potential threats could arise without having the Second Amendment in this country. That is why the Founding Fathers put it there. I always love the line. It's kind of a bumper sticker to say, but the Second Amendment is there to protect the first. And I don't think there's any better way you can put that.
Very well said, Jack. We only have about a minute and a half left. So I want to ask you this. What do you think the impact of Steve Scalise coming out and giving an interview, even after being shot, saying his experience with what he went through solidifies his views on the Second Amendment, that it should not be regulated or touched and should be left alone? Do you think that's going to have an impact on any of the Congress or the Senate?
I think it absolutely should. I mean, we saw the standing ovation that the Congress gave Steve Scalise when he returned to the House, and rightfully so. And then he came out there and he pointed out that if his security detail did not have guns on them, that he would not have been there to make that walk into the House. He would not be voting today. He would not be here today if James T. Hodgkinson had been allowed to continue on with his slaughter, to continue on and kill all the Republican Trump supporters that were there that day. So to him, he's looking at it from a perspective of, why would I deprive the rights of families, deprive the rights of women to be able to defend themselves in these cases from another potential James T. Hodgkinson? Because he's looked down the wrong end of a rifle. He's been on the receiving end of that, and he knows what it feels like to unfortunately feel defenseless in the face of a crazed gunman.
Very well said, Jack. We are out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, the super PAC.
Rev18pack.com. Yeah. Sorry. Rev18pack.com and hashtag
Rev18.
Rev18.
Yes. Thanks so much for having me on, guys.
Jack, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you for doing what you're doing. You keep up the good work, and we'll continue to promote your stuff.
Yeah, love you.
Great.
And you're listening to the best of the Hagmann Report. That was Jack Posobiec. No best of Hagmann Report would be complete without hearing from one of my, seriously, a good friend of mine, one of the most prolific writers and analysts of the media, as well as analysts and intellectual of other issues, but really the media. Now, I don't want to speak out of school at all here, but this next guest, Peter Barry-Chaka, I've grown to know and like, and I'm going to tell you something. I consider it an honor for me to be able to call him my friend, my personal friend, Peter Barry-Chaka. And he's got just a wonderful, he's just a wonderful guy. But in this next piece, Peter Barryczauka is going to be talking about the latest, the absolute latest about the Fox, what's taking place at Fox News. And why is this important? And I've said it so many times, because Fox News is the cutting edge and really the only stopgap between the complete takeover of the media. You get rid of, really, Sean Hannity in particular. You get rid of him, for example, and the entire corporate mass media will be completely contained and controlled. And I think that has been the objective. But Peter Barryczauka, appearing here within the last 10 days, actually to talk about, really, what's taking place. Kind of an assessment of the corporate mass media, but specifically Fox News and Sean Hannity, to give you his analysis as we celebrate, again, the nuptials of my daughter, Jackie, to Eric the Tech. Congratulations. And I want to thank you all for your kind and warm wishes to them and for being part of our extended family. But let's take a listen to now Peter Barryczauka. Some absolutely incredible information, good stuff. Take a listen. And to talk more about that and other things, Peter Barryczauka, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Doug. Glad to see that you made it home safely after your weekend in Branson.
Hey, yeah, indeed. And I apologize for the call. The phone died. So, I mean, it died.
That's what I assumed.
Yeah,
okay. I mean, I enjoyed the time we did have on the phone while you were driving.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Hey, I'm new to this newfangled technology. Anyway. Cell phones. But anyway, Peter, good job on the reporting, the concise, extremely great reporting on what's been taking place behind the scenes at Fox News. I know you've got impeccable sources. Let's talk about what's happened over the last 48 hours.
Yes. Yesterday, Monday, the long-awaited official announcement came down from Fox News about the new fall schedule that's going to be starting next Monday. And that is that Tucker Carlson will remain at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, prime time. Sean Hannity, who's currently our personal favorite for a variety of reasons that we discuss at length, he's moving from 10 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And that's significant because also at 9 o'clock on MSNBC is Rachel Maddow. She's been in that time slot for 8 or 9 years now, and she has finally risen to the number one position of all cable news shows after the demise of Bill O'Reilly this past April. So Sean Hannity will be taking her on one-to-one, and the new program at 10 p.m. will be Laura Ingraham, and she will start her show on October 30th. Now, I had a heads up on all of this about 6 weeks ago, and I reported it about 5 weeks ago, both at American Thinker and at the Hagman Report, in two articles which laid out the schedule. Now, meanwhile, everyone else in the media, both mainstream and alternative, literally everyone, was saying that Laura Ingraham would be the one to get 9 o'clock, and then she would go head-to-head with Rachel Maddow, so we would have two women, or I should say Rachel Maddow and Laura Ingraham, going at it. But my source said at the time, no, it's going to be Sean Hannity. And I was happy to have that small vindication yesterday. So, you know, with the assistance of course, American Thinker and the Hagman Report to publish it. And we discussed this as well on more than one program in August. So I think we all deserve a small round of applause for getting the story right. Not that we will get any credit for it.
Of course.
But, you know, that's the way it is. It's a small footnote, but at least we're on the right track.
Peter, why is this important? Because some people might say, well, so what? But it's important. And, you know, what's the importance behind this?
Well, you know, I'll start answering that question by noting that I heard your program this morning, Doug, and you were really fired up. It was incredible. But you sketched out how one of the fronts in the media war, the war for information, the info war that we're currently seeing in real time, is that which is going after, it's targeting, attacking, and trying to destroy the alternative so-called media, including apparently the Hagman Report, as you commented on at length this morning. Well, we know that wars have multiple fronts, both shooting wars and info wars. So another really important front on the info war is that which is occurring in the mainstream media, and that is now boiled down to the Fox News Channel, because there is no other major mainstream media outlet at this point which is not in the tank, which is not controlled by the shadow government, the deep state, et cetera. Or if not controlled, it's in sync with the objectives of this nefarious group of forces that are taking us down. Fox News is the last one. And we know that Fox News is not perfect. We've discussed that many times. They have too many leftists on that channel for my taste. But in prime time, for the 3 hours in prime time, they're still pretty good. Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, and of course, our favorite Sean Hannity. And not to name drop here, but you were, I heard the first hour of your program before I came on tonight, and you were mentioning Sean Hannity. And by the way, I have to thank you for giving me a heads up yesterday on Sean Hannity's radio show, which I then found the podcast to and included some reporting on that in my article today at American Thinker. But as usual, I emailed that article to Sean, and he just tweeted it a short time ago. He tweeted the link to American Thinker as opposed to retweeting my tweet about it. But that's okay. That'll get it many, many more page views. I mean, instantly you'll get like 1,000 tweets. So I was actually emailing him back and forth right before we went on the air here, and I told him that I'd be doing this show and what the topic was, and he said, fantastic. So I've gotten to know Sean over the last several months, and I can personally testify to the fact that he's really a good guy. It's really incredible that somebody at that level of success, visibility, and financial remuneration is a really down-to-earth, decent individual. So, you know, bravo to Sean Hannity. And
he is a great guy. I've never had the opportunity really I certainly haven't met him, I'll just say this. I admire him because, you know, he's taken a lot of hits and he's survived a lot of hits, but he's still running. He's still running at full capacity, full speed. And I think that the internal war at Fox News, whatever it might be, with the Murdochs and how that has played out for his mere survival, and then not just that, but thriving to go head to head against the MSNBC Mad Cow performance, the carnival there of Russian the Russian carnival, that to me gives me a lot of hope, Peter. It really does. I've got a lot of hope for the truth prevailing at least during that hour of cable news.
Right. I mean, the good news about prime time on Fox News being in the hands of three pretty sound and sincere conservative individuals, all of whom are, by the way, religious individuals, Tucker, Sean, and Laura. I mean, Laura always wears a cross every time she's on television, a gold cross. But that shouldn't, though, reassure us too much, because the battle goes on around us, including at Fox News. And I think this is a temporary victory. I think it's going to be a slog from here on out to see that these three credible people can maintain their positions there in the face of the Murdoch boys, the two sons of Rupert Murdoch. And I have it on very good authority that what made it possible for this schedule to go forward in prime time starting next Monday, which also includes, by the way, that terrible program, The Five, going back to 5 p.m. And I mentioned, I had several paragraphs in my article today about American Thinker, about The Five. I mean, that show, and in particular, Juan Williams, is just impossible to take. So thank God we'll have a real alternative now at 9 p.m. Eastern time. But The Murdoch boys are still amassing their control of the Fox News schedule. And as I started to say, I have it on good sourcing authority that what made the difference in this new schedule going forward with conservatives is Rupert Murdoch. He can still tell the boys, back off, this is what's going to happen. But Rupert is 86. You know, I hope he has a long life ahead still and can maintain his position there. But the reality is, who knows how long he can maintain that. And the boys are waiting to get full control of Fox News. And I'm afraid we're going to see it really go into a debasement zone, not the basement, but debasement. And but for the moment, it's working just like we're fighting on all the other fronts. I mean, we're fighting daily battles on the alternative media front as well. So nothing is a given. You know, I heard you say earlier, Doug, that after attending the Branson conference that to paraphrase you, I think hopefully correctly, that you are convinced more than ever that we are approaching or on the verge of or within the end times. And I have to say that I agree with you. And I just wanted to mention this briefly. It's a little off the radar here, but I don't know if you've seen this story yet. Drudge linked to it, and I read the article. It's Dateline Belleville, Illinois. I mean, this is indicative of this is the story today that has me most concerned of everything that we're seeing in the news today. In Belleville, Illinois, which apparently is a small town that's in, close to St. Louis, because this is courtesy of the Fox 2 St. Louis TV station, they reported that on Sunday, a football team of a grade school there comprised of 8-year-olds. It doesn't say what race these kids are or anything about that, but the 8-year-olds apparently were aware of what's going on in St. Louis this past weekend. You know, the objections of the mobs to the white cop not being, you know, found guilty of killing the alleged drug dealer, violent man in 2011. But so the kids knew about that. And one of them said to the coach, you know, a black man was killed and a white perpetrator is not being held accountable. And the coach, I guess, nodded his head in agreement. These kids also knew about the case of Colin Kaepernick and his actions of refusing to stand for the national anthem and instead kneeling. So all the kids on this eight-year-old grade school team said, would it be okay for us to kneel instead of standing for the national anthem at our game on Sunday? And the coach said, yes, of course. So they did. And the report from this Fox News channel is that the parents did not disagree with this. And I'm thinking, here is an example of what we face with the newest, youngest generation. You know, words like Hitler Youth come to my mind, you know, that you get them as young as possible and the die is cast. So, I mean, God help us. After reading that story, I was ready to throw up my hands and give up. But now we go forward doing what we can with at least people who will hear what we're saying and reporting and doing. But This is indicative of the challenge that faces us.
How old were those children? Was that 8th grade or?
No, 8 years old.
It says eight years old and under. It was a grade school team.
Okay.
A school called the Cahokia School.
Okay. I missed that. I was in my time there, I was obviously too focused on St. Louis. But you know, to me, okay, would you have thought at that age of ever doing that? Of course not. Joe, I mean, you
would. Well, I wouldn't have thought at that age of, excuse me, I wouldn't have thought at that age or even younger of being so interested in sex, in transgender, in homosexuality. But, you know, kids today are getting that indoctrination in kindergarten, if not earlier, in the state school. So, I mean, everything is upside down. So I guess this really shouldn't surprise us. And yet it did. It's currently listed on the left-hand column of the Drudge Report below the title, but it's well worth a look. I mean, it's a mind-boggling story. But, you know, again, it's part of the info war. These kids are being subjected to an info war at their level of grade school. And the coach reinforces, I mean, he's certainly no Coach Dave Dobermeier, that's for sure.
That's right.
But he's fine with their
well, do you see an issue with an ridiculous, 8-year-old tackle football player?
Sick, evil decision to crap on the flag and the national anthem. He's fine with it. And apparently so are the parents of these kids, if we can believe this report at Fox News, Fox 2, St. Louis. But you know, I'm going to see if there's any more reporting on this story because it's just really piqued my interest and maybe it's something I can write about. But, you know, as a journalist, I'm sure you're finding the same thing on any day now.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
such an avalanche of stories that, I mean, there aren't enough hours in the day or in the week to address the stories that come out in a couple of hours now.
You know, I just want to say this, Joe, and I know you got something to add, something to say to Peter. But, folks, the Peter Barry Chalka is the only person I know who works more than I do. Okay. I don't know. He's got like 26 hours, 27 hours in a day, but, and he's awake during like 24 of them. Seriously, this man is works. You really do. You're an incredible powerhouse. And I'm not trying, I mean, that's not flattery. That's just fact. When I called him, I don't know. Yesterday, when I spoke with you yesterday, you were only sleeping for a couple of hours, having worked the entire night researching.
Same thing happened today when Joe called me. I'd been asleep for about an hour.
But, it's amazing.
You know, the call comes, and what are you going to do? You've got to rise to the opportunity. I'm not going to say no to an opportunity like this to chat with you guys and share information with your audience. So, you know. Whether we have no other option at this point, really.
Well, we don't. And the only other addition I want to make to that statement, aside from in addition to working hard, that is your source is plural on matters of media. No pun intended for media matters, but on matters about the media and inside channels and your contacts. And, of course, your relationship with Sean Hannity is just an amazing asset to this program, and we thank you for it.
Thank you for the opportunity to share it. And, you know, I mentioned on the earlier program that I did a segment of with Joe and John today that this very day, August 19th, that we're meeting now, is the four-month anniversary of the first article that I wrote about the cable news wars that was published in American Thinker. And there have been at least 40 or 45 articles since then on that range of topics, cable news wars, the info wars, Fox News, in addition to other subjects that I've written about too. But I thought I had no idea then in writing that initial article about the challenges facing Fox News back on May 19th of what was ahead, including Sean Hannity, of all people, reaching out to me shortly thereafter because he was reading my articles. And, you know, and then our getting in touch in June and doing all these programs and now my contributing to the Hagmann Report. I mean, you know, it's really incredible. As I told Joe earlier on the phone when we were talking off the air, it's been a really long time in my media career, which spans 45 years now. A really long time since I've had collaborators or an outlet such as you guys represent, and American Thinker to an extent too, but really the Hagmann Report is my favorite venue to work with right now, and it's because of you, Doug, Joe, John, Eric, Jackie. You know, the media enterprise that you have built is just incredible. And as I was saying to you off the air yesterday, Doug, it deserves many articles. It deserves highlighting on its own for what you have built from the ground up and ever expanding here because the need is there and because the truth is there. You are speaking truth to power unlike anybody else that I'm currently in touch with, and a consistent, dedicated, and spiritually informed way. That is it represents the complete picture. I mean, as a journalist, who could want for more than to have found colleagues and brothers in arms like you guys? So, you know, I thank you for that every day, sincerely.
Well, and Peter, you've been doing some great work as always, and posting a number of different topics when you write your stories on Hagmann Report. And I like the diversity in your reporting, especially that article on St. Louis you did.
That was fantastic. You know what, Joe?
It was very good.
And if you, ladies and gentlemen, if you have not read that article, I learned a lot from that article. In fact, Peter Barry-Chalka on American Thinker and on Hagmann Report, of course, the St. Louis article.
St. Louis Blues.
Right. The links in there that were pretty obscure, you know, he provided. And thank you for that.
Well, you know what was one inspiration, Doug and Joe? Of course, I was following the St. Louis story very, very closely, both online and on cable news, because the news channels were covering it live. And when it's a live story like that, you can really pick up a lot when there's no delay and you're really seeing what's happening on the street. But that first night, I happened to hear a news report, top of the hour news on radio station KGO San Francisco, 50,000 watt station. And I'm still trying to track down who provided that network newscast to them. They don't say on their website, so I'm just going to have to tune into them again and see. But here to paraphrase the news, here's what they said. Oh, we're now going to go to, I believe, Dan Simon on the streets of St. Louis. And this is paraphrasing what he said. He said, well, there was a big demonstration today, peaceful, hundreds of people protesting, you know, the verdict in the case. And later at night, a small group broke off and went to the mayor's house. And someone threw a rock and broke a window. And at that point, the police responded with tear gas to try to disperse the crowd. Now, if you heard only that report, you'd think, oh, massive demonstration, peaceful, you know, a small group of renegades broke off and broke a window. It was lies from beginning to end, based on everything I had seen on even on CNN and certainly on Fox News and on the internet. So I thought, you know, I'm really going to have to look into this. And of course, almost all of the reporting throughout the weekend did not get into what was this case about? Who was the perpetrator who was killed? Who was the cop? I didn't see anywhere it reported, except in an obscure story from the Kansas City Star, that the cop in the case, who was acquitted on Friday, was a West Point graduate and a veteran of the Iraq War who had received a medal for his service there. Yet he was portrayed as, you know, probably some kind of renegade white supremacist cop who shot this poor innocent black man. And, you know, we don't have time to go into all the details, but if people can get my article, yeah, a lot of it's in there, including links to the primary sources, including the 30-page opinion of the judge in the case, which is well worth reviewing. But
I read that, and to me, that judge was really looking for a hook somewhere in that. But right. that was just my interpretation of that court opinion.
Well, it's very similar to what happened in Ferguson, when the Obama Justice Department sent, I think, dozens of attorneys to try to get the goods on the police officer on that. In that case, Darren Wilson was his name, I think. He's probably had to change his name by now. And after all this investigating of him going back to, I think, the day he was born, you know, they could never find anything to hang on him for a civil rights or hate offense. And, you know, eventually he was acquitted, but of course his life was pretty much upended, if not ruined, in the meantime, as this cop probably will be too. I mean, it just breaks your heart. And then, you know, when you see, unfortunately, I hate to say, the lowlife who was the perpetrator in this case, alleged, well, he was convicted. He was a convicted drug dealer, violent crime, gun crimes.
Peter, we got about 30 seconds left just to give you a heads up here, as the music's going to start playing soon.
Well, I'll close out with saying people, listeners, viewers, tune into Doug's show in the morning. Tune into John and Joe's show in the afternoon and continue watching the skies and watching this program and going to the Hagmann Report, because we're trying to pull together to speak truth to power as best we can, motivated by the good book. And that's what we're doing.
Peter, I want people to follow you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
It's twitter.com/pchowka. P-C-H-O-W-K-A.
Folks,
appreciate that.
Okay, yeah. Please follow him. Follow Peter Barryczowka on Twitter, pchowka. I do. And I'll tell you what, let's flood him with a bunch of followers because his message is important. Thank you, Peter Barryczowka, for checking
in
with us.
Thank you so much.
All right.
And once again, thank you so much for joining the best of the Hagmann Report. Next up, partial interview with Dr. Jerome Corsi, Partners in Crime. We're discussing his book, Partners in Crime, available, of course, at the WND Superstore. Use promo code Hagmann. Here are the salient points from that recent interview with Dr. Jerome Corsi. Going to leave you with this, and may God bless you. Tomorrow night, Dr. Ted Brewer sitting in for Doug and Joe. Here, meanwhile, is Dr. Jerome Corsi.
The things about your book, and again, Dr. Corsi, Partners in Crime, referencing Hillary and Bill Clinton, the Clinton Foundation. And it's interesting how you wrote this book, and people that have no idea about the enormity of the scam, I'll call it that. That's my phrase now, that the Clinton Foundation is. If anyone who's read that Peter Schweitzer's book, Clinton Cash, this would serve as kind of like the college level course beyond that, or the addition beyond that, perhaps. But even if you haven't read Peter Schweitzer's book, Clinton Cash, this really is an educational research document, 352 pages of just solid information. What do you think is the most egregious? Well, even before that, Clinton, 2001, getting out of the White House. Clinton's getting out of the White House, the co-presidency, saying they're dead broke. Was that a true statement? I mean, were they dead broke back then?
It's not a true statement. I mean, it's part of the grifter mentality that the Clintons have. They are always seeing themselves as broke, wondering, you know, where the next meal is coming from, and they're acting like that. But at the same time, Hillary had a book contract coming out of the White House, which I think was a $10 million advance. It was a multi-million dollar advance. I'd have to look into the book to see the exact amount. Yes, Bill Clinton had a lot of legal debts, but his legal debts were because of, you know, his philandering. Basically, the Paula Jones case, the Monica Lewinsky case, these cost the Clintons a lot of money. The Mark Rich pardon, which Clinton did, also was under investigation by a special prosecutor at the time. And by the way, it was combination James Comey and Mueller who put an end to the Mark Rich investigation. They are Clinton fixers. That's another separate story. But the point is, the Clintons even stole the silverware out of the White House. You know, I write a whole section in here where they come out of the White House with the furniture and the antiques, all of which are property of the people of the United States and the museums and the archives. And they get caught. They end up having to return a lot of the property they took out of the White House. And they end up having to pay fines and pay taxes. I mean, this is kind of egregious behavior, this crying poor. And then you wonder, you know, basically, they come out, they say they're broke in 2001. And, you know, over the next 14 years, Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, make over $230 million. And a lot of that money comes out of the foundation. Now, I don't see that being dead broke. you know, their two homes cost a combination of $5 million, which they bought right away. You know, the Clintons, if anything, should have considered themselves to have been two of the most fortunate people in America, to have come out with as much money as they had and as much opportunity as they had. I mean, certainly, if you look at past presidents, Harry Truman, you know, never left the White House with a $10 million book contract. And these are the kinds of things that, you know, the American public, I think, finds very hard to excuse when a hard look is taken at the Clintons. But the point is, you know, from the Democrats and from the left, the Clintons get a pass on all of this, and people, even in the Department of Justice, are either protecting them or, you know, afraid to prosecute them. Attorneys generals don't want to take on the Clintons. They figure they may end up themselves, you know, in pushing flowers up from their graves. You know, I mean, that's and so the Clintons have created a master kind of a criminal operation here, in which they cheat everyone, don't pay taxes, and are protected by the globalists with whom they're cavorting and promoting mutual interests, which are not the mutual interests of the American people.
You know, Dr. Corsi, when I was looking over, rereading parts of your book today, and I know that in this section, in the initial part of the book, or the first couple of pages, you were talking about inurement. You know, yeah, sorry about my inability.
That's
to,
correct, inurement.
Right. Which, in other words, diverting funds for personal profit, self-enrichment. And where, and again, you give a lot of credit to Peter Schweizer, Clinton Cash, and his expose about the, you know, about the Clinton Foundation. I guess with all that said, why aren't they, is it just because of everyone's guilty in Washington? I mean, you're inside the Beltway now, serving as the Washington Bureau Chief for InfoWars. Is everyone corrupted? And is that why they're not in Prison Orange, both of them?
Well, there's an awful lot to be said that point is true. I mean, I think you find Washington has come to be a place where on both sides of the aisle, both parties, you have senators, congressmen who are coming away with millions of dollars. They go into lobbying firms. There's a rotating door between the military and military industrial contractors. You find that Washington's a place where people do a few years of public work and then cash in on it. And they cash in it on K Street, where there's all the consulting firms. They cash into it in corporations. And the Clintons, I think, felt like they were entitled to participate in this kind of what I consider to be egregious wealth. I mean, and I make the point in the book, the Clintons could never get enough money. That, you know, no matter how much they made, they always felt like they were running out. And they always felt like they needed more. The avarice is phenomenal. I mean, you know, if we take a section, just take the India section for a minute. With, you know, you get an earthquake that occurs, and I'm just taking a look at some of the book here in 2001, which is 6 days after Bill Clinton left the White House, and there's almost 20,000 people killed in India. 166,000 injured, 4.5 billion in property damage. It's, by the way, it's the third anniversary of the day Bill Clinton went on television to say he didn't have sex with that woman. And so what do the Clintons decide to do? Well, immediately, 1 week after the earthquake, Bill Clinton speaks with one of the top criminals in India. You know, it connects with the prime minister, and Bill Clinton says, I'm going to go over to India, and we're going to raise $1 billion to help the earthquake victims. Now, first of all, the Clinton Foundation at this point is set up with only one purpose, and that is to build the presidential library. And according to the charitable rules, 501c3, you've got to have what they call a Form 1023, which takes your articles of incorporation and says, here's our charitable purpose. The only purpose for which the IRS gave what they call a determination letter to the Clintons to raise money on a tax-deferred basis was to build the presidential library. So Bill now decides he's going to go off to India. He has no legal standing as a charity in India. There's no Clinton Foundation in India. Clinton Foundation in the United States is not authorized to accept donations for India earthquake relief. And, you know, Bill Clinton doesn't pay any attention to those issues. They set up an America Indian Foundation. I guess that was in their recognition that they needed some U.S. entity. Again, it's not in any way defined as a 501c3. There are no 1020. There's no filing statement that this is a charity. It's not registered anywhere. It's completely off the books. And Clinton goes off and he says they basically raise $1 billion. Now, no one knows where the $1 billion goes.
That's a problem. That, seriously. I know a little bit about the filings. If you are a charity, and I think this is what you're saying, if you're a charity, you've got a stated purpose for IRS, for the 501c3. And if you deviate from that, you can't do that. Even if it's a legitimate, if there's an earthquake in India or whatever, and you want to divert that money to flood victims in Houston, for example, you cannot do that. It's nice, but you can't do it, according to the law, to the IRS law.
And Mr. Corsi, if I can ask you this, you made a statement that the Clintons never could get enough money. They always acted or said that they were broke, regardless of how much money they had. Why do you think that is? Do you think that's just the way that they are? Do you think they have some stated goal in mind that they're working towards?
Or is that their mentality?
Yeah.
I think it's a combination of things. I think, first of all, there is a psychological element in it. I basically take a look at the Clintons, and I think that they're both essentially – you know, they come from poor environments. They basically are con men. They have all their lives been looking to bilk other people, especially Bill and, of course, Hillary, along with her, you know, Saul Alinsky leftism, feels she's entitled to everybody else's money. So there's a psychology that, you know, that they need somehow to steal money in order to have it. They can't deal with getting it honestly. I mean, I've come to think almost there's a fundamental issue at the heart of the left, where the left feels guilty about actually earning and deserving money. You know, they feel like everybody who has money stole it. I mean, here's, you know, this is your, you know, Howard Zinn theory of the history of the United States. We stole everything by exploiting Indians, Native Indians, black slaves, etc. And once you've got that kind of capitalist, you know, view of your socialist or Marxist in orientation, you feel like anytime you have money, you've stolen it. Or anybody who has money has stolen it. So they all kind of get that mentality. Now, with the Clintons, I think it's at the point of a disease. Because, you know, as I go through even this chapter on India, so they don't bother to register the foundation. They start working with a group of Indian criminals, you know, in terms like this Raja Gupta, who was a managing director of McKinsey. He's one of the big players in this American India Foundation. Well, he was with another Indian. They were trading on insider information. They both went to prison. And then they signed
$5 million fine. Yeah, you got a $5 million fine for insider trading. Yeah.
Right, and they decide they're going to raise this $1 billion, and they start holding these black tie galas around the United States to raise more money. And they're holding the black tie galas with this American India Foundation in cities in states where they've never registered as a charity. So all of the registration requirements, all of the financial reporting, which you've got to have audited financial statements, if you try to find the money raised by this America Indian Foundation, it's impossible to track it down in terms of audited financial statements or where the money went. Certainly the public statements are way out of line with anything they appear to have raised. And then, you know, but that's the pattern. The Clinton financial statements are terrible. They're disgraceful. They are, basically fraudulent to any accountant would appear to be patently fraudulent. I mean, the Clintons have run here not a minor fraud, but a major fraud of vast proportions with no attempt at all to follow the rules. And if they're going to be raising this kind of money internationally, which is a theme throughout my book and theme throughout what they've done, you know, because they've worked with some of the biggest con men in the third world and sold their prestige for money to the foundation and into the Clinton Global Initiative, which, by the way, they created again without registering as a charity. I mean, how do you have a annual conference where people make pledges and you consider that this is a charity? Now, the Clinton Global Initiative never filed a Form 1023. It never got any termination letter. They basically decided that if Davos could charge people to come to Davos, well, the Clinton Foundation could hold the Clinton Global Initiative like Davos, and they could charge all these wealthy people who wanted to be influenced, you know, peddlers, and to hobnob with the Washington elite. They could charge them big fees for coming to the Clinton Global Initiative and then get commitments for charity, make it look like it was a philanthropic activity. But what they were doing is they were basically, from the start, selling influence through the Clinton Global Initiative, charging everyone $20,000 just to attend the meeting. And, you know, then you got friends of Bill, and they're beginning to make six and seven figure donations or pledges that are publicly announced at the Clinton Global Initiative annual meetings. That translates into camera time on stage with Bill Clinton, and the money is supposed to go into the Clinton Foundation. Now, whether or not it actually does, and I tracked it, only a very small percentage of the money that was ever pledged at the Clinton Global Initiative is actually contributed to the foundation. So, you know, and the whole thing is outside the realm of the IRS control because it's, you know, not a registered charity with a IRS determination letter, but it's operating kind of in a rogue fashion. And the accounting of it is slipshod,
right?
If at all.
Right.
And is the Clinton Global Initiative a separate corporation? Is it a program of the Clinton Foundation? What's its corporate status? Well, again, that's problematic. Now, do they have separate accounting, or is everything consolidated into one financial statement? Well, sometimes they separate account and sometimes they consolidate. And so by the time you're finished looking at the Clinton financials, you've got a complete mess. And that's the nature of everything they've done.
Yeah. Now I've got a couple of questions, about three or four questions. By the way, we're going to forego the bottom of the hour break and give you the extra time, Dr. Corsi. And, that way we can just cram as much in as possible. But again, the essence of the book, Partners in Crime, to our viewers and listeners, I believe personally, after reading this, you could use this as the basis for a criminal indictment.
Easily.
And I'm just astounded that I haven't seen that there is none. But now, I guess working backwards here, where does the Clinton Global or where does the Clinton Foundation and the various offshoots, where does that stand today, given the fact that she's kind of irrelevant in the presidency? She didn't assume the presidency. Where does it stand today?
Well, they have not closed the Clinton Foundation down, and they continue to talk about they might hold another Clinton Global Initiative meeting. Now, I think they're finding that with Hillary having lost the presidency, they're not able to do influence peddling. They're not able to sell the kind of pay-to-play scams because they can't deliver anything out of, you know, as they could when she was senator or when she was Secretary of State. And so I think their contributions are way down. But they have not closed the foundation, and I think they're going to try to revamp it in order to be the stage for Chelsea, because the Clintons seem to want to stay in the game in order to promote Chelsea's political future. And then I've just started writing with Charles Ortel some articles this week in Infowars.com, where now you've got the Barack Obama Foundation, which is playing the same game. They have a IRS determination letter to do the presidential library, the Barack Obama Presidential Library in Chicago. But if you read the rest of the articles we'll publish this week and next week, they're merging in a program from the White House called My Brother's Keeper Alliance to find mentors for inner city kids. But again, you can't merge a program from the White House into a foundation, and there's no IRS approval for the foundation that was constituted to build the Barack Obama Presidential Library to go off onto a inner city kids charitable mission. But it doesn't seem to bother Barack Obama any more than it bothered the Clintons. And you know what we have here, if this does not get investigated and prosecuted and shut down, is you've set up a scam where future presidents who are rogues can come out of the White House or any other head of state, create their foundation, and go on an international plundering scheme.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons I think I'm so determined to still continue to pursue this and see if we can't completely shut it down and bring the Clintons to criminal justice.
I agree. And I think that needs to happen because during her tenure as Secretary of State, I mean, she really just used her position, sold her soul, sold the United States out. What was the most egregious, in your view, the most egregious part, crime or activity, I should say, when she was Secretary of State?
I think it's the one in terms of the Frank Giustra in Canada and the fact that this was a guy who was a penny stock dealer who decided he was going to go into the oil and gas business, the uranium business, and began with Bill Clinton to try to get uranium contracts out of Kazakhstan. They finally set up a company, Giustra does, and gets Russia involved. They make contributions out of Canada to the Clinton Foundation, and they end up getting 20% of all uranium in the United States through a company that Giustra set up that's now owned by Russia. So the Clintons managed to get through this Committee for Foreign Investment in the United States a acceptance that it would be just fine if, you know, this company set up by Frank Giustra, now owned by Rosatom in Russia, ended up with 20% of all the uranium in the United States. Now, that's just egregious. I mean, can you imagine if George W. Bush had tried something like that?
Oh, man. The progressives and Democrats talking about Russian collusion, my goodness, they invented Russian collusion, at least economic collusion, for self-enrichment. And selling America out as well, given the fact, what uranium could be used for.
Well, also, I mean, you know, they decided in 2002, basically, that they were going to go after this HIV AIDS, and they were going to get it with Ira Magaziner, who's one of their long-term criminal buddies in Massachusetts, and they were going to go to India, where they could get generic drugs, discount, for HIV AIDS and send them to Africa. Well, the drugs they bought were poison. They were defective. They couldn't cure anybody. They probably do more damage than good. And they brought the defective drugs again with their buddy, their criminal buddies in India. And they conned this Unit Aid, which is a taxing scheme on airlines, which about five countries participate in. France is the major one, which runs through the World Health Organization, part of the UN in Geneva. And the Clintons end up saying, well, just give us that money. So they end up with $400 or $500 million out of UNITAID, again, which no determination letter. They set up a Clinton HIV AIDS initiative, which is not a separate foundation. They get shut down, by the way, in Massachusetts. Massachusetts becomes so angry at how they're operating the foundation, they shut them down for a year. But they continue operating in Massachusetts. That's where they run the HIV AIDS initiative out of. They essentially scam UNITAID out of at least, I'd say, $500 million. And there's no proof they cured anybody of HIV AIDS. But yet, while Hillary was Secretary of State, they go about, you know, saying all the good work they've done to cure HIV AIDS through the foundation. The money largely goes missing. The accounting is shoddy. They bring in countries like Ireland into the scam. The Clintons aren't registered as a foundation in Ireland, but yet they're there soliciting money for HIV AIDS along with France into this Clinton Health Access Initiative, which it becomes a partner with Irish Aid. And they're starting then to send off to in Mozambique. And, you know, they're, I mean, the whole thing is completely a concocted scam, which sounds like it's doing good work, but how conscionably do you steal, as the Clintons did, $500 million with defective drugs from India and then trying to convince the world that you've helped to cure AIDS?
I know Joe's got a question about the I don't know if this is the right time with the flow, but he's got a question about the latest release of Judicial Watch's emails, because I know you've worked with Tom Fitton. Joe.
Yeah, the Hillary emails, how do they fit into what we see as far as the fraud from the different initiatives in their foundation and the money that they've been raking in? How do they play into this?
Well, the for a long time, the ones that especially that I think Hillary said she destroyed and the ones that have not been public that Tom Fitton is now getting, further document, someone contributes money to the Clinton Foundation, and they have a project, and they want to meet people in the State Department who can clear the way for them for a venture they want in one of the foreign countries. Well, these emails from the Clintons in offline in their private server come in from through Huma Abedin, typically through Huma Abedin, and Huma is saying, well, we've got this donor, and this donor wants to have a meeting with in the State Department or a meeting with in the federal government, and Hillary sets it up. And then the donor uses that meeting for a business purpose somewhere in the world. And basically, the emails document the pay-to-play scandal, where people who are contributing to the foundation know that that's the price in order to get the attention of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to open a door for you within the State Department or within the federal government. And so no matter what you want a telecommunications contract, or you want to, you know, build a road or some kind of construction project somewhere in the world, and you want State Department blessing, well, you contribute to the Clinton Foundation, call up Huma Abedin, ask for meetings with Hillary Clinton to arrange with the appropriate government officials, and lo and behold, the meetings get set up.
Man.
And your deals get done.
Pay to play.
Pay to play.
Pay to play.
And well, even worse, because, you, well, self-enrichment, selling out America, essentially, you know, as they did in, with the Lincoln Bedroom, now it's on the global scale. I'm sorry.
Right. And see, what I point out in Partners in Crime, why I focused a lot on Enormant is, in pay to play, you've got to prove intent. You've got to prove the connection, the nexus between the contribution made and the, you know, the favors that were granted through the government. And the Clintons can always say, oh, no, we would have done that anyway. But, you know, in Enormant, when the money goes missing, and, you know, I've got in here a whole chapter showing with this health aid initiative where they end up with, you know, $60 to $100 million just missing off the balance sheet, and they reorganize the company so that in the reorganization, you know, $20, $30 million just comes off the table. Now, you don't need to prove any intent. All you have to show is that the lifestyle, and the Clinton Foundation, you can demonstrate regularly, is running at maybe 3 to 5% of the money they bring in actually being spent on a charitable purpose.
Wow.
With the rest of it going to salaries, overhead, expenses, travel, lifestyle. I mean, the Clintons are, you know, spending 96% of all the money they take in to spend, to use 4% of it for charity.
Hell, they got to pay their bills, though, Dr. Corsi. My goodness.
Right. Got to pay their bills.
I'll tell you what, if I ran this agency, or, you know, our network like that, I'd be strung up and hung, but in jail, but nonetheless, wow. And folks, Partners in Crime, the Clinton scheme to monetize the White House for personal profit, it's available at WND Bookstore. Use promo code Hagman. Just go there, go to Hagman Report, click on the banner link, and go over there and order the book. Order two, as a matter of fact. It's a great deal. One for your neighbor, because people need to see this. But Dr. Corsi, if we can kind of switch a little bit here, you're the Washington Bureau chief for InfoWars right now. Can I ask, can we just veer a little bit? And it's up to you, but what are we seeing taking place with this Mueller Manafort? My goodness, this revelation about the two FISA wiretaps, and of course now the lies by DNI Clapper, and you know, what did Obama know? And you've written extensively about this, or about the troubles. But what are we seeing right now with what's going on in Washington, as in your capacity as the Washington Bureau Chief for InfoWars.com?
Well, I mean, I'm concerned, and I've been trying to warn the White House. I mean, I think, first of all, I've written extensively about both Comey and Mueller, who have a long history of being Clinton fixers. I mean, the one of the more egregious cases there is the HSBC Bank. I'd worked for 25 years in banking before I began writing, and you know, I switched careers when I wrote Unfit for Command. And John Cruz, who had been an officer in HSBC in Long Island, brought about 1,000 pages of customer accounts, and he was trying to get somebody to pay attention to him. Well, I looked at him and I saw immediately that HSBC was running a money laundering scam. And we brought it. I started writing about it in WorldNet Daily and yep. WND, and we brought it to the attention of the Senate Permanent Investigating Subcommittee and the Department of Homeland Security. Well, it turns out HSBC was running billions of dollars in drug money and terrorist money around the world, hundreds of billions of dollars. And on the board was James Comey.
Of course,
the head of the FBI, which did nothing about this until I began publishing it, was Mueller. And the U.S. attorney who was in charge of prosecuting this was Loretta Lynch,
no.
The Southern District. Eric Holder was the attorney general. Well, finally, they negotiated a $9 billion fine from HSBC. But nobody went to jail.
Oh,
now,
man.
I'm sure that the Obama administration was into that hip deep, and
sure.
That the CIA, and you know, a lot has been written on this since Orion Contra, and since the, you know, the disclosures of the Vietnam War, the Church Committee, and others, but especially the Tower Commission. Knowing that the CIA has been deeply involved in the international drug trade. Now, you can't have an international drug trade without laundering money, because, you know, trucks full of $100 bills don't do you much good. So this was a criminal scheme that CIA had to know about, probably was operating. The FBI had to know about it, as well as the Treasury. Everybody was hiding it. And Comey is on the board. no real penalty to Comey. Mueller's head of the FBI had done nothing to it until we exposed it. Loretta Lynch organized the criminal penalty. Everybody walked free. Now, those are the people who are also involved in the Mark Rich, dismissing the Mark Rich pardon. And it goes on and on with the number of things that, you know, Comey was involved in, not just Hillary's emails, a long sequence of saying, oh, we're not going to prosecute. And Mueller going right along with it. Now, they're in there, and they're going to do one thing. They're going to try to prosecute Manafort and probably General Flynn on the Russia involvement, one way or the other. But regardless, I'm convinced they're going to charge President Trump with obstruction of justice because he fired Comey, and say, put the crisis in, saying, well, you know, he needs to recuse himself. What do they charge him in a criminal court? Not just impeachment. And they're going to do it. I mean, I was saying this about Comey during the election. I was going to say, if Comey's in charge, there will be no indictment of Hillary on the emails, because he's never indicted Hillary. He's never recommended taking it to a grand jury and indicting in all these different crises. And twice he exonerated Hillary. And right now you've got to set up, and Mueller is going to do what he can to destroy the, to get Trump either to resign or to be impeached. And it's coming down. It will happen.
And you know, look, I'm going to tell you something. If you, coming from you, Dr. Corsi, if you say it's coming, I truly believe it, because of your inside, you've got so many inside contacts, your research is impeccable, your experience is everything. But how soon do you see this? Is it, given the rapid nature, I was surprised, first of all, the raids of the Paul Manafort home and his storage facility, the storage unit he had. I was surprised how quickly that happened. And then I was surprised with the rumors now coming out about the potential indictment of Manafort, Paul Manafort, but also the extent of the FISA wiretapping. Just amazing. So you think this is going to be like sooner rather than later, like within months? I know you can't, you don't have a crystal ball here, but my goodness, are we that close to?
I don't think it'll stretch out too terribly long. I think that the first thing they're going to try to do is to pressure Manafort or Flynn into becoming the John Dean. You know, John Dean,
sure.
Watergate, was happy to lie and turn in Nixon as long as he got a limited prison term. And he was the one who cracked in the Watergate to work with the prosecutors, special prosecutor. I think they're going to try that. I mean, the idea of breaking into Manafort's home at 5 a.m. and photographing all the suits in his closet and all the Italian suits in his closet and, you know, bringing off, that's unnecessary. That's thug tactics. That's, sure. You know, Manafort's not going anywhere. He'd be happy to turn over all that to the FBI in a reasonable, all they have to do is go get a search warrant. And or request that the material be turned over, and I'm sure Manafort would work out the arrangements and turn it over. Right. Very civil process. But, you know, to come in like thugs in the morning, you know, like the Gestapo knocking down your door at 5 a.m. while you're in bed with your wife, I mean, this is really frightening kind of behavior on behalf of the FBI. And, you know, where's Jeff Sessions?
I was just going to ask you that. What's up with that?
I mean, the only way you're going to be able to get any containing on this is if you immediately begin an investigation of Comey and Mueller.
Right.
And there's plenty of information out there to investigate the two of them, and they should be investigated. And then also, I mean, you know, we've got Comey, who had the tarmac meeting that went on with Bill Clinton and with Loretta Lynch, and Comey was told to change the definition of the criminal investigation into a proceeding, yep. You know, which was Hillary's meme at the time. This is just a procedure. It's not an investigation, a criminal investigation. And, you know, the cover-ups, the lying, the writing memos to himself that he refuses to hand over. All of these are issues to me which would more than justify firing Mueller and going after both of them. What about investigating Obama?
Yes.
For the extensive wiretapping that we now know was done, and I've been reporting this since March, of Donald Trump and his campaign. And with, I mean, wiretapping, electronic surveillance through the NSA.
Yep.
You know, you have James Clapper under oath asked if U.S. citizens are still being under electronic surveillance from the NSA. And he says, not wittingly. Or is that, that answer means yes.
Right.
What do you mean, not wittingly?
As a director of the DNI, that answer, if that was even a genuine answer, that would be frightening as the director of the DNI, or the DNI. My goodness.
And from everything that Snowden has released, and I have no reason to believe that any of that was false, the NSA is essentially collecting electronic surveillance on every American. Right. Now, whether they read it or they don't read it or they just archive it, they've still got it. All phone calls, all Skype messages, all emails, everything is captured and archived in this, you know, glass puzzle palace that is the NSA. Well, who's gonna check the NSA? I mean, both the NSA and the CIA are rogue. We know this going back to, you know, Americans just seem to have a lack of, you know, ability to remember this. But go back and pull out the Church Committee.
Oh, yeah.
On the, you know, extensive lying the CIA did to cover up their involvement in the Kennedy assassination, fully documented the Church Committee.
Which you've written on your book at WND Superstore, I believe.
I've written extensively on the Kennedy assassination and the CIA's role in it.
Yep.
Look at the CIA and Iran-Contra, the Tower Commission.
Yep.
Look at the CIA's role in Mossadegh in Iran.
Yep.
Or, you know, in Guatemala, where they assassinated the head of state for a banana company. You know, that John Foster Dulles and his brother Alan Dulles had stock in. I mean, this is it's fully documented that the CIA has been and continues, I believe, to be a rogue operation. Not an intelligence gathering operation, but a covert action within the American government that is the deep state, the pinnacle of the deep state. And together with the NSA, you know, they have all this information. Why aren't we investigating President Obama for the unmasking, Susan Rice? You know, we've got McMaster still giving Susan Rice security clearance.
Exactly. You've got the floor. 3 minutes, I believe.
Well, I'm writing a book now on this, and I'm very concerned that if Trump doesn't fight back, and he can fight back, but he's got to understand that a coup is underway, and the deep state does not intend to allow Trump to rule, and he better take a hard lesson from John Kennedy, because in the final analysis, if they can't control him, they'll assassinate him. And the attempt's going to be made in the next 6 months to either get Donald Trump to resign or to get him impeached or to declare him mentally incompetent. But Mueller is going to play a big role in that. How quickly is it going to come down? I think it could start coming down in the next 60 days. It'll start with Manafort. It'll start with Flynn. And then they're going to try to have it be ready to, you know, produce the charges against Trump and before he has time to act. And then Trump is going to be faced with either a criminal indictment or advice going into the House for an impeachment on obstruction of justice. Those charges don't have to be provable.
Right.
Mueller does not need to be able to prove the case. He just needs to be able to make an indictment. We can make an indictment right now.
Does the Civil War follow? I mean, what happens with that? Is the breadbasket of America, the farmers, the, the truckers, the people who really put him in office, are we going to, what are we going to do? Or are we going
to? Well, they're going to try right now. If they're trying to take enough time where Mueller, when he does this, and he's going to do it,
yeah,
can make it look to the American people as if he had a basis for it. And right now, it's been hard to find the basis for it. And the fact that Grassley has come out and pointed out that Comey was writing basically his statement that was going to exonerate Hillary before he'd heard all the testimony was a setback to Mueller's plan to bring obstruction of justice charges. But the whole meme on the Russian collusion has largely fallen apart, although they probably will find technical violations and other issues on which to charge Flynn and Manafort in the attempt to get them to agree to cooperate with the special counselor and to say that Trump knew everything and he was guilty from the beginning, just like John Dean did. But I don't think that's going to work. So it's probably going to take them into sometime early next year before they're really able to make their move against Trump. But it's underway right now. It's being considered. That's the assignment Mueller was given, and he intends to do it.